Tune in Sundays at noon Eastern Time or 9 a.m. Pacific Time for the Sunday Wire for 3 hours of action-packed talk radio on 21stCenturyWire.com and AlternateCurrentRadio.com.
Suffer from arthritis or have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? SharmTech, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. SharmTech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharmtech.org.
Expressed on this program by its guests do not necessarily reflect the views or beliefs of the host or radio network, and this program's sole intent is to help educate, foster critical debate, and help raise and discuss political and social issues which already exist in the public domain. Thank you and enjoy the program.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this week's edition of the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you so much for joining us this Sunday. It's episode 118, and this is Sunday, January 17th, 2016. Thank you as well for everybody's listenership last week. It was a fantastic program. If you've missed that episode, you can go back in the archives just below on the show page and listen to that episode, and also on Spreaker and on iTunes, and also for all the other shows, too. Same principle applies. Listen at your leisure. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you today. We've got a couple of fantastic guests who hopefully we're going to connect, and they're in different parts of the world. In the first hour, we're going to be joined by an extraordinary political global affairs analyst. Her name is Sharmeen Narwani, and she's going to be joining us from a live link from Beirut, Lebanon, to talk about fresh events on the ground in Syria and also in Iran, two places where she's been reporting from on the ground frequently as of recent. And also in the third hour, we're going to be joined by a very special guest who has his show is now being carried on the Alternate Current Radio Network. Richie Allen from the Richie Allen Show is going to hopefully join us from Albion, from the United Kingdom, from that little world, that realm, that England, somewhere up there in Manchester, I think, in the Midlands. We're going to try to connect Mr. Richie Allen to talk about lots of things to do with, well, the media, the press, and where things are heading, and also about his show, too. So we're going to also try our best to get to some of the top news stories from around the world. We'll just start off now. Before we get to this first story, the big issues in the news right now in America are the Iranian, all things Iran, the Iranian nuclear deal. 11 U.S. sailors were captured, as it were, and also held on an island, much to the dismay of the neoconservatives and everybody in the media who were just flying off the handle. And CNN was running point on this particular operation. It was all resolved within 24 hours, but in the 24 hours before it got resolved, they just went absolutely crazy with speculation, calling it a provocation by Iran. And when you actually look at the story, it's two U.S. boats somehow drifted into Iranian waters, and you consider the tension in the Persian Gulf. How is it possible that two U.S. PT boats, little gunboats, they call them riverines. They used to call them PT boats, but they've changed it to riverines now. And how could you stray into Iranian waters? Don't they have that thing called a global positioning satellite technology? I mean, we've got it in our cars, right? So you'd think that the U.S. Navy has it in its boats, but we're meant to believe that this was an accident and this had nothing to do with the fact that President Obama was going on national TV within a few hours to give a State of the Union address, and nothing to do with the Iranian nuclear agreement, which is being implemented that day and this week. And I think there wasn't a coincidence, as evidenced by some of the characters that the networks were rolling out and some of the rhetoric that was coming out with regards to the story. So one of the guys they brought forward was Tom Cotton, okay? Tom Cotton, the Republican senator from Arkansas, who is sponsored by the Israeli lobby. I'm not exaggerating there. He is sponsored by the Israeli lobby. They pay him lots and lots of money. They help to get him elected, at least over $1 million. Over $1 million to buy his loyalty and get him to say things like what he's coming on here. So he's basically saying, now we've got to release these prisoners or hostages, they called them, and this is an act of aggression. Well, we can get into the details of it, but this is the fear that was being ramped up at the time. You only have to go back and listen to the reports. And the fact that they had CNN had this guy ready to go, like the biggest pro-war, the most aggressive voice in terms of global conflict, Tom Cotton, a 38-year-old Army veteran, Harvard graduate. It's a very strange new breed of warmongering technocrat. They're all coming out of Harvard, apparently, these days. So Harvard is become Israel's kind of academic proxy on the East Coast in America. So go ahead and roll this clip, Tom Cotton, this audio clip, and listen. This is Wolf Blitzer and Tom Cotton. Wolf Blitzer is obviously, his job is to get the tensions up. Get the tensions up, get people thinking, aggressive, use abrasive terms like our enemy and hostages, state-sponsored terror, Iran, bad enemy. Go ahead and roll this.
Vessels with 10 sailors on board. Stand by. I want to bring in Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He's a key member of the Senate Intelligence and Armed Services Committee. He's also a combat veteran who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Your reaction, Senator, to the fact that Iran is now holding 10 Americans. They say they've arrested these 10 American sailors, and they are in Iranian custody together with those two small vessels.
Well, Wolf, this kind of openly hostile action is not surprising. Exactly what I and so many others predicted when President Obama was negotiating the nuclear deal with Iran, that it would embolden their aggression towards the United States and our allies in the region. I also want to react, though, to something Jim Sciutto said just before I came on. He said, according to a senior administration official, there's no sign of hostile intent by Iran. Think about that for a second. Senior members of Barack Obama's administration are apologizing for Iran seizing two U.S. Navy vessels and holding 10 sailors hostage. The White House tonight is a hotbed of cold feet.
It comes just before, 4 hours before the president's address before a joint session of the U.S. Congress. And in that speech, we were told the president would mention the Iran nuclear deal as a very positive step. You, together with all the Republicans, voted against it. It's about to be implemented, as Jim Sciutto said. Billions and billions of dollars in sanctions are about to flow to Iran. Is there anything you can do to stop that?
Wolf, I don't think the timing of this intercept of our two naval vessels in the Persian Gulf is coincidental. Rarely are matters coincidental when you're dealing with...
Okay, pause. So you heard Tom Cotton, rarely are matters coincidental. He just said it right there. Rarely are matters, but what he's doing is subtly trying to spin that to in favor of his conspiracy theory that that somehow the Iranians made this happen. They made this, they conjured the boats into Iranian waters, and then they took our soldiers or sailors hostage and then paraded them around on TV. And look on Twitter. I can't tell you how many images I'm seeing on Twitter saying, stop the humiliation. They show this photo of these guys who, I mean, I'll be honest with you. They don't look like sailors to me. Okay. I've seen Navy guys, midshipmen, people work in the Navy. These guys don't look like Navy guys. They look like Special Forces guys. Okay. Little subtle little detail that I think a lot of people didn't pick up. And I spoke to my Army intelligence guy, and he said to me flat out, he said, Patrick, it's just about impossible that this could have happened unless it was intentional on the part of the United States. Okay. So that's where it stands. So go ahead and let's hear the rest of Tom Cotton. Go ahead.
The Ayatollahs in Iran. First off, it's humiliating to Barack Obama and therefore the United States to have American sailors held hostage during his final State of the Union. Second, as you say, the nuclear deal is about to be implemented, maybe as early as this week, in which Iran is going to get over $100 billion to continue its campaign of terror and aggression throughout the region and around the world. This is the Ayatollahs trying to get maximum leverage and inflict maximum humiliation on the United States and on President Obama. Unfortunately, that's been the story we've seen since the nuclear deal was signed in the summer, and it's what we can expect to continue for the next coming months. It won't be the final humiliation. It's just one more sip from this bitter cup that will be offered again and again.
You used the word hostages, Senator. A lot of us remember it's 1979, 1980, when American diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, they were taken prisoner. They were held hostage for 444 days. When you use the word hostage, are you referring to that experience? Because that would be awful, obviously.
Well, Iran has a history of both holding American hostages and trying to kill Americans, whether it's in Iran or Iraq or Lebanon. And now they've seized two U.S. naval vessels. I would say put the map of the Persian Gulf back up on the screen, Wolf, and your viewers can see how improbable it is that those naval vessels going from Kuwait to Bahrain along the Saudi coast would have ventured into Iranian waters. It would seem to me much more likely that Iran...
Pause. Okay, it will seem to me, says Tom Cotton. I love these guys. Okay. It seems to me. So he stands up there, this 38-year-old punk from Harvard. Okay. Who, went along for the ride in Iraq. And, so he can get his, veterans credentials. Okay. It seems to me, he says. It seems to me it's improbable that two naval vessels traveling from Kuwait to Bahrain could have strayed into Iranian waters. Well, Tom, I got a little news flash for you. They did. They were in Iranian waters, okay? You are such a fool. I mean, I can't... You know what's more extraordinary about this is that the empty vessel known as Wolf Blitzer... I say that, lights out, nobody home. He's there, but he's not there, if you know what I mean. That Wolf, the empty news anchor will never question this guy. So this tells me this was all rehearsed, and they bring up the Jimmy Carter Iranian. I mean, how long ago was that? 1979. Is that 40 years ago? Almost 40 years ago. And they're somehow saying this is relevant to this event. It's not relevant. But the news media package is all scripted. And so the truth about the Iranian hostages in 1979 was that though they could have been released a lot earlier, but the Republican establishment, and I'm not just singling out the Republicans because it's a fact. They used back channels to sandbag the release of the hostages to make Jimmy Carter look bad. And then when Ronald Reagan made it, was free and clear, they did the dramatic release of the hostages and Reagan got credit for it. That's historical fact. That's called gamesmanship. And that's exactly what this event was. I don't know for sure, but it seems to me like these two little PT boats, insignificant, ridiculous little boats, were intentionally put into Iranian waters to be captured, okay, to create a media stunt, to get the reaction, and to be spun exactly as it's being spun right here on CNN and all the other media networks in America, with the biggest instigator and senator who's most in the pocket of the Israeli lobby. And I don't know about the Saudi lobby, but I don't know if he gets money from them too, but definitely Israeli lobbyist sources. That's well documented. You can go ahead and Google that. We've reported on it. This is completely, and so this is a neocon stunt, is what it is. Go ahead and resume this clip, and it gets worse.
Waited to the time where they would have maximum leverage to conduct this operation, as Jim Sciutto noted, by the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the shock troops of the Iranian regime.
Because I've always suspected, and I know U.S. intelligence analysts have always suspected, that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, in this particular case, much more hostile to the United States than the government, per se, the Foreign Minister Javad Zarif or the President Rouhani, that there are, in effect, two Irans. One supports the Iran nuclear deal. They're trying to make it work, but the Revolutionary Guard Corps has always been skeptical, opposed, but they've been forced to go along because the Ayatollah says they should go along. How do you see that division within Iran?
Well, Wolf, there may be two Irans, but the division isn't between moderates and hardliners. It's between hardliners and harderliners. The Revolutionary Guard Corps is intent on spreading the Islamic Revolution around the world. That's the founding principle of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Revolutionary Guard Corps is the keeper of that revolution, and they are largely responsible for killing our soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not surprising now that they're boasting on Iranian TV.
Okay, pause that.
They intercepted...
Okay, so now Iran is largely responsible for killing our U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Okay. And no challenge from CNN, from Wolf Blitzer. So that is an imaginary scenario voiced by a hawkish U.S. senator, and no one challenges it. It's a total lie. Iran didn't kill our soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. First of all, Tom, and everybody else, any soldiers who died in Iraq or Afghanistan who were U.S. soldiers, the ultimate responsibility for their deaths lays with the United States federal government in Washington, D.C. Ultimately, okay? Does anyone want to challenge me on that? Because they weren't off fighting for freedom or saving the world from Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and Afghanistan did not attack the United States. Not on 9/11, not ever. Okay? So Tom Cotton, that's one layer of fiction. Tom Cotton, what he's done and what CNN has facilitated is to put another layer of fiction on top of that fiction. And this new layer of fiction says that Iran is somehow responsible for killing our soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. So basically, any of the jihadis in the world, the Ayatollahs of Iran are hiding behind them and puppeteering them. This is the conspiracy theory that Tom Cotton is peddling. Okay? It's totally ridiculous. And yet it goes unchallenged. They give them the pulpit, they preach, and none of it's real, none of it's true, but what it does is it penetrates the minds of those people who are receptive to this sort of propaganda. No mention of the fact that the Mujahideen and the Al-Qaedas of Afghanistan largely are the responsibility of the United States intelligence apparatus and black ops and all the clandestine activities that made those fighting forces a reality in Afghanistan, in Bosnia, and by extension, ISIS later, and all the rest of them. No word from Tom Cotton on that. No responsibility there. Go ahead and listen to the rest of this.
Two small naval vessels that are holding 10 American sailors hostage.
Stand by, Senator. We have a lot more to talk about, including some suspicion out there, already out there, that this Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, they would like to scuttle this Iran nuclear deal for whatever reason. Stay with us. We're following the breaking news. 10 American sailors now being held by Iran, as well as their two small Navy vessels.
Okay, so that's pretty self-explanatory. Anyway, but we'll talk more about some of the ins and outs of this with our guest at the top of the hour, Sharmi Nawani. And we've got the hawkish stuff, we've got the uproar, we've got other things going on. We've got a narrative, Iran versus Saudi Arabia, that's very prevalent too. And so meanwhile, Fareed Zakaria, who is GPS is the name of his show, and it doesn't mean global positioning satellite. It means something else, but I never actually found out what that is. It's like Global Village or something like that. So Fareed Zakaria is a CFR member, Council on Foreign Relations, and so he's part of the establishment. He's their sort of little plant they've got in CNN to handle global issues and control the conversation on the global themes and how we should see the world. His job is to tell us what we should think and how we should see the world. So he got a bee in his bonnet this week. Apparently, someone was trolling Fareed Zakaria. So a fake post from one of those onion-type sites made it onto Facebook, and it got shared, and Fareed is absolutely upset. He can't believe that anyone would troll him. Okay, so now he's basically pointing the finger at social media, saying there needs to be features in place to stop bad information from spreading on social media. Okay, so I guess Fareed just realized this was a problem. You know, some of us have been getting trolled for a decade. Okay, so it's no big surprise. It happens. It's part of, it goes with the territory. It sucks, but it happens. Okay. But he's all bent out of shape because he's in his little monopolist, information monopoly position there at CNN. They just don't like anything that goes on below the line. So he's blaming social media. So Fareed, misinformation. This is the beginning of his lecture on misinformation. I'm going to quickly break this down. So go ahead and roll this clip. Fareed, misinformation.
But what if these new technologies encourage misinformation, rumors, and lies? In a comprehensive new study of Facebook, analyzing posts made between 2010 and 2014, a group of scholars found that people mainly share information that confirms their prejudices, paying little attention to facts and veracity, as Cass Sunstein wrote about in a recent Bloomberg article. The result, the study authors conclude, is, quote, the proliferation of biased narratives fomented by unsubstantiated rumors, mistrust, and paranoia. The authors specifically studied trolling, the creation of highly provocative, often false information, with the hope of spreading it widely. They write that many mechanisms cause false information to gain acceptance, which in turn cause false beliefs that once adopted are highly resistant to correction.
Okay, pause there. Okay, so I don't know how to say this, people, but Fareed Zakaria was just describing what CNN is. A source of misinformation, putting out lies that's highly incorrectable once they get out into the public domain. Isn't that what CNN's been doing for the last 30 years? Promoting all the wars. We just heard Wolf Blitzer doing it there with Tom Cotton, ratcheting up tension. And this is the network that Fareed Zakaria is sitting there with that logo below his runner. And he's giving a lecture on misinformation from Facebook or something like this. And he's just mortified that bad information can spread so easily and people sharing it and talking about it. Well, he's just as easily describing what he does for a living and what his network and his bosses do for a living. And mind you, are getting very rich off it. Okay. The people who are sharing the stuff on Facebook that he's decrying, they don't really make any money off it, but he's making millions per year. Just him and the rest of them. They make millions pumping out lies and not just misinformation, disinformation. Continue.
Happens in recent weeks. I was the target of a trolling campaign and saw exactly how it works. It started when an obscure website published a post titled CNN host Fareed Zakaria calls for jihad rape of white women. The story claimed that in my private blog, I had urged the use of American women as, quote, sex slaves, unquote, to depopulate the white race. Disgusting. And so much so that you'd think the item would collapse of its own weightlessness, right? Wrong. Here's what happened next. Hundreds of people began linking to it, tweeting and retweeting it, adding their comments, which are too vulgar or racist to repeat. A few far-right-wing websites reprinted the story as fact. With each new cycle, the levels of hysteria rose, and people started demanding that I be fired or deported or killed. For a few days, the digital intimidation veered into the real world. Some people called my house late one night and woke up and threatened my daughters, who are 7 and 12. It would have taken a minute to click on the link and see that the original post was on a fake news site, one that claims to be satirical, but doesn't really make that clear. It would have taken simple common sense to realize the absurdity of the charge. But none of this mattered. The people spreading this story were not interested in the facts. They were interested in feeding prejudice and hysteria. The original story was cleverly written to provide conspiracy theorists with enough ammunition to ignore evidence. It claimed that I took down the post after a few hours when I realized it received negative attention. So when the occasional debunker would point out that there was no evidence of the post anywhere, it made little difference. When confronted with evidence that the story was utterly false, it only convinced many that there was a conspiracy and cover-up. Elizabeth Colbert, writing in The New Yorker, recalled an experiment performed by two psychologists in 1970. They divided students into two groups based on their answers to a questionnaire, high-prejudiced and low-prejudiced. The students were told to discuss with each other controversial issues like school busing and integrated housing. Then the questions were asked again. The surveys revealed a striking pattern, Colbert notes. Simply by talking to one another, the bigoted students had become more bigoted and the tolerant more tolerant. This group polarization is now taking place at hyperspeed around the world. It is how radicalization happens. I love social media, but somehow we have to help create better mechanisms in it to distinguish between fact and falsehood. No matter how passionate people are, no matter how cleverly they can blog or tweet or troll, no matter how viral things get, lies are still lies. For more, go to CNN.com/Fareed and read my Washington.
That's right, Fareed. Lies are still lies. And let's just pontificate on that for a minute. So he's saying this is where radicalization comes from. Welcome to the real world, Fareed Zakaria. Okay. Welcome to our world. Okay. This is what most people who actually use social media, who don't have personal assistants to tweet for them. No, I won't mention any names, but all of you guys. Okay. This is the real world. Okay. And let me tell you, you want to talk about radicalization. Let's think about that for a minute. You're worried about, you know, getting threatening phone calls or, you know, people calling your house and threatening your daughters, etc. Okay? Because of bad information that's been put off by somebody on social media that any idiot can see is a fake. Okay? Okay, let's compare that to what you do for a living and what CNN does for a living, or what, let's say, bad information that's being used to create radical responses. How about this? How about the BBC using recycling old footage from Yarmouk in 2014 and mixing it into a Madaya news report recently in the last couple of weeks to basically trigger public outrage and calls for humanitarian intervention in Syria using basically fake footage, okay, and then putting that out to 100 million people globally to brainwash them, to go for whatever the agenda is, whatever NATO's agenda is for Syria, okay? How many people are going to die because of U.S. airstrikes or coalition airstrikes or Saudi carpet bombing Yemen because people like you are whitewashing it? Or let's talk about, well, we want to talk about CNN's fake war footage, staged war footage, misinformation, disinformation. How many lives has that cost? How many children have been killed at the hands of Western military industrial complex equipment, munitions, bombs, drone strikes, because of the propaganda you put out to make the public opinion soft enough on that issue that they'll accept intervention or regime change, which your network calls for every 5 seconds. Regime change. We need regime change. Let's talk about the lies of what's going on in Syria. Barrel bombs. How many times have I heard this? I hear it a lot, but I don't see a lot of evidence. Or Assad killed 250,000 of his own people. We all know, now we know that that's a jacked up figure that is been cooked up by a combination of Western-funded, Western-backed NGOs who call themselves human rights organizations. And you, on your program, will cite those bogus statistics to back your case for a bombing run to carpet bomb Syria or to carpet bomb Yemen. Totally bogus, total misinformation, total disinformation, and you have the temerity to give us a lecture on social media and trolling. CNN and BBC and these networks, ABC, Charlie Rose, all, you guys are the biggest trolls. You're the king of the trolls. Okay, the trolling that you do really costs lives. The trolling you did in advance of the Iraq war, your network, pushing all the fabrications, all the lies. How many million Iraqis have died because of that? Let's get our perspective in order here. Because I don't see any coming from your high-minded ivory tower diatribe that you've just delivered to me this morning on your program. I think you people in mainstream media have got it completely upside down and backwards. And you use these little stories to basically point your little, you know, your academic studies and all these high-minded establishment institution talking points, and you point them back at the people, you know, us at the bottom of the hill. Start your little avalanche, and the stones roll, and we get crushed by your little cartel of information, opinion, and your little monopoly on what are the main cultural talking points or zeitgeist points for the day, the week, or the year. Your false flag factory, fear factory, is a good description of what CNN does. It's a fear factory, 24/7. Fear, tension, military tension, the world's at war. This is what you do. And then the ads come on, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Lockheed. And you think, wow, okay, yeah, okay, so they're funding the network. And then the network people, the talking heads, are hyping up tension and promoting war. So, of course, any fool can see the equation here. It's not rocket science. Okay. Now there is a lot of misinformation, disinformation, fake stories. Someone just posted on my Facebook page, a news story, which the headline reads, Putin orders 100,000 troops with atomic weapons to prepare to obliterate CERN's underground research site in Switzerland, you know. And this has been posted by the People's Voice and a website called yournewswire.com. Okay, this is a fake story, but it's not a satirical website. This is a website that puts out these stories as if they're real. Okay, you can go ahead and look at it. It's on the internet. It's on our Facebook page. But that's blatantly a fake story. But, you know, that story is not that different from what CNN does. Because this Putin orders 100,000 troops with atomic weapons to destroy the CERN Hadron Collider. This is basically misinformation that's designed, disinformation that's designed to create fear of Russia, for instance. So I don't know who's behind it, who's doing it. It's probably from one of those bogus websites, like Sorchafal or whatever, whatdoesitmean.com. And maybe this People's Voice person here hasn't figured out that that's a disinformation site. I think it's pretty obvious. But, you know, I see this stuff every day is my point. And, you know, and smart people can look at that. And then they go and they click through, and then you Google the website, you read about it, there's been some critiques about it. You know that it's basically a fake story. Okay. So, no big deal. But for Fareed Zakaria, it seems like this is all like new to him, which is unbelievable. So let's just get back to our friends at CNN. So, there was a beginning of the week, there was a bombing in Jakarta. Okay. Now, this was anyone who's really looking closely at this story. And this is Indonesia, multiple explosions gone off. ISIS claimed credit on a social media account. So that's good enough for CNN and Fareed. That means ISIS did it. As far as they're concerned, it's case closed, right? So let's look at this story real quick. So Jakarta, Jake Tapper, so Tapper, Jakarta Online, roll that clip.
ISIS claimed responsibility for the Jakarta attack in an online statement, which could mean that ISIS or ISIS-inspired individuals have now been behind at least three attacks that happened within days of each other just this week. Is ISIS expanding its reach? Let's bring in CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr. Barbara, as Ivan Watson just reported, Indonesian officials are still trying to piece together the evidence. Can you walk us through what exactly happened?
Jake, here is the starting point. Make no mistake, ISIS expanding its reach across the globe. The moment of the attack in Jakarta captured on camera. ISIS claiming responsibility. It began with a suicide.
Look. So that's Barbara Starr. It's a woman with glasses on and a bad wig, okay? And it could be a comedy sketch. It really could be. And she's the Pentagon correspondent. And then the dramatic voice, the music behind, the explosion sounds, this is all theater, people. So she's on. ISIS fears that ISIS might be expanding its reach. Okay? That's the agenda. It's to get you to basically think that ISIS is everywhere. This is so familiar. This is like Bin Laden. You remember Bin Laden? Remember when he was everywhere back in 2002, 2003? I mean, he was everywhere. Bin Laden was spotted and, you know, he had cells in Japan and, you know, you name it, Antarctica, Bin Laden. They wanted us to think that basically he was under your bed. Okay, it was the boogeyman. Okay, that was the psyop with Osama bin Laden. And so, lo and behold, CNN's amazing. Last week, they had their guy in Paris when this ISIS attack took place with a fake suicide bomb vest. We talked about that last week. Turned out to be a jacket. They shot the guy dead anyway. Forget about him. And so, they just happened to have their guy in Jakarta as well. really good timing. Ivan Watson, who's sort of like the Martin one of Martin Savage's proteges, good looking guy with the voice, doesn't know a whole lot, but has a good voice. So here's Wolf Blitzer with Ivan Watson. And actually, no, roll this Jake Tapper, Jakarta, and the first Jake Tapper clip. Roll this real quick. Just listen to what he says at the beginning. The I forgot what the full title, Empty Lead, it's called.
Welcome to The Lead. I'm Jake Tapper. We're going to begin today with yet another deadly terrorist attack, this one by ISIS, eerily similar to Paris. Massive bomb explosions and a violent shootout rocked Indonesia's capital city of Jakarta this morning. It all began when one of the terrorists detonated a suicide bomb near a Starbucks in a bustling shopping district in Jakarta. That's an area that's usually packed with tourists from around the world. And then, in an alarmingly coordinated manner, other terrorists launched a gun battle with police. At least two civilians died.
Okay, okay. So alarmingly coordinated manner. Okay, that's a good one. I like that. Alarmingly coordinated manner. Alarmingly coordinated. So did you catch, if you listen closely, Jake Tapper said, and I'm doing this without the picture, so I'll describe to you what the video looks like. He says, in a bustling shopping area that's usually filled with tourists from around the world. And as they show this, he's saying bustling shopping area. And you look at the video of this little puff of smoke going up, which is meant to be the bomb, okay, in front of a Starbucks at an intersection in Jakarta in Indonesia. Said, normally bustling. There was nobody there. So this is at broad daylight, busy, normally a busy day. There's nobody there. And then you see the little bomb go off. Poof. So it's incredible. It's almost like they cleared out the intersection to prepare for the terrorist attack. And they've sort of filmed it. And it I don't know. Is it just me? And he said it right there. Normally busy. But he didn't tell you that why it's not busy, or didn't ask, where is everybody? Okay. And so here's Ivan Watson. So with Wolf Blitzer, intrepid reporter Ivan Watson on the scene of the bombing. I don't know how they got him to Jakarta so fast, or he just happened to be there. You know, they do luck out now and again. Just listen to this. This is Wolf Jakarta Ivan Watson.
Well, it now is becoming apparently clear to the Pentagon and others that even though ISIS senior leaders are dug in Syria and Iraq, they are extending their influence, if not their operations as well, across the world. Wolf?
Barbara Starr reporting from the Pentagon. Thank you. Let's go to our senior international correspondent, Ivan Watson. He's joining us from the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Ivan, show us where this attack took place.
That's right. It's before dawn here right now, Wolf, but the attack began over here. This is the Starbucks cafe, the Starbucks where a suicide bomber walked in and self-detonated. And then this busy intersection in broad daylight became a battle zone as the attackers moved through with guns, throwing grenades, attacking behind this barrier here a traffic police post. Now it's decorated with these floral condolences messages that are calling for unity among the people of Indonesia. And this one message, which is very important, Kami Tidak Takut, that is an Indonesian hashtag right now. It says, we are not afraid. That's something that the Indonesian president said. It's something I've heard from Indonesians who've come here in the dead of night to pay their respects to some of the victims here of this, the worst terror attack that Jakarta has seen in 6 years. Wolf.
Ivan, what have you learned about the man, the authorities there believe?
So they had all the signs ready with the flowers around it. Very ornate decorations had been organized almost immediately. And the hashtag campaigns are rolling out very much like Je Suis Charlie and Charlie Hebdo. So, you know, if ISIS is well organized with its bombings, I think the media reactions and all the public decorations and everything is even better organized. Okay, because it's fast. It's almost like instant. It almost seems like it had been organized ahead of time. If, you know, you could make that argument. Of course, we're not, who would make such an argument? You know, who, as if. But, I find the whole thing just very odd. Very odd. And he keep busy intersection. He said it again. And then you look at the film of the bombing and there's no one there. So it's strange. You know, that's all we can say. So Indonesia allied with Russia. Yeah, you could say so. Good place to have an ISIS attack? Yeah, absolutely. Not from ISIS's point of view, but from a geopolitical point of view in terms of strategy of tension, it's a very good location to have a so-called terrorist attack. And we're going to see more and more of this, you know, these sort of random bombings and an ISIS claiming credit on a Facebook account or a Twitter account or some, or through site intelligence. Will say that they took credit for it or whatever at this, you know, sort of thing. So same old thing, same old story. Again, different versions, different locations. So I'm not convinced that all of this is real, obviously. Yes, stuff's happening, but I think it's a lot of it's staged. And, well, history proves that much of it is. So, it'll just be a question of time before the facts come out. And maybe it'll come out from a while from now, but they will eventually come out with regards to some of these so-called terrorist events. Anyway, we can get into that later. We're going to connect our next guest. So we're going to take a short commercial break, and we're going to connect our first guest live from Beirut. Stay right there. We'll be right back. This is The Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen.
Steve Austin, astronaut, a man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger, faster.
To find the perfect life, a brand new car. this ball and chain.
Secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Sharp Tech, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharptech.org.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the Alternate Current Radio Network and also at 21stCenturyWire.com. Thank you for joining us in the second hour. And we're joined by our next guest. She is a commentator and a Middle East analyst, global affairs analyst, and also she is a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College, Oxford University, and has a master's degree in international relations from Columbia University. Her name is Charmaine Narwani, and she's joining us on the live link, hopefully a stable link, from Beirut, Lebanon. Thank you for joining us today, Charmaine. Okay. Hello, Charmaine, have we got you there?
Hello.
Hi. So, yeah. So we got a little problem with our connection. Hopefully she can hear us. Can you hear us, Charmaine? Hello? Okay, so we're having some problems with the connection. So I'm not sure if we lost the connection or not. We'll try to hopefully reconnect her on the other end. So while producer's trying to reconnect her, if you do get her, give us a shout, let us know. She's joining us live from Beirut. So we're going to talk about, hopefully if we do get her back on the line, we're going to talk about the
I'm here.
Ah, there she is. Thank you for joining us. We've got you.
I warned you about the Beirut connection.
Yeah, I'm all too familiar with the quality of the internet and telecommunications there. So, but we'll do our best. But thanks for joining us, Charmaine. I don't know if you heard the introduction, but we talked earlier about setting up this segment, and things are changing very quickly. And news stories are coming to the forefront each week. This week, you know, everything that I kind of had planned to talk with you about has a little bit been pushed slightly to the side. Iran is back up into the headlines, at least over here in the United States, with the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, plus the two U.S. naval boats that so supposedly strayed into Iranian waters, and the sailors that were returned in 24 hours. So this is what's going on. The United States is very divided politically, over anything Iranian. Okay. We'll talk about Syria too, but just on this front, how is this drama looking from your side, of the pond? With regards to Iran and the United States and the so-called nuclear deal?
Well, there's a split in the Middle East as well, as you can imagine. I mean, Iran's quite happy about the state of affairs, and Saudi Arabia and Israel are not. So this is the divide we had going into the Vienna Agreement last summer, and this is what we're still with, unfortunately, on implementation day. So, you know, it depends where you're looking at. In Iran, I think, as we've seen from news reports, the collective mood is very positive, very encouraging. Iran has been under siege of sanctions for far too long and has really suffered as a nation and people individually, not just the government. So, you know, this is a real breakthrough, and a lot of people thought perhaps we'd never see this day. Of course, we have. Sanctions have been lifted, or at least the UN sanctions. And it's a new day. But of course, as this is happening, there's an escalation of activity against Iran on other fronts in the region, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, more about in this show. Particularly Saudi Arabia and hostile actions and hostile comments that continue and worsen, it seems, as the weeks go on.
And so we just also had the release of the prisoners, quite a few American prisoners that were being held in Iran for various reasons. And one of them was Jason Rezaian, who is a Washington Post journalist, who had been held for, I think it was 545 days or something like this. And so these so-called Americans are calling them hostages, but they're in prisons, or they're been arrested for, I would assume, espionage and things like this. And so they're saying, well, we have Iranians in U.S. jails. This is what I heard this morning on CNN. But they're there. They're real criminals. But really, when you look at the Iranians held, they're for violating sanctions, some of them, in the United States. And so, again, this is the sort of dialectic from the United States' point of view. Anything Iran does is bad. Anybody held there as a hostage, not a prisoner, and everything's nefarious with nefarious intent, and anything the U.S. does is justified and moral and correct by international law. So this is the dialectic. So, but I mean, what were the charges for Jason Rezaian from the Washington Post? Was it espionage?
Do you know, I'm not exactly sure. I've read about his case over time, but I'm not sure that there's ever been a lot of detail included. The Iranian judicial system has been tight-lipped over these things, perhaps because they don't control the international narrative and know that whatever they put out there will get twisted. So they've kept mum about a lot of these cases, and there are others that are ongoing. But my impression is that espionage, sabotage, passing of information has been the mainstay of the charges for a lot of the Iranian Americans who have been detained in Iran, but not not all of them by any means. And I think we'll learn more now that we've seen a release.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And you're absolutely right. You know, the discourse, hostages versus prisoners. I mean, just the way these two naval boats were taken in. I mean, I think Iran probably did what any nation abiding with international law would do. You take in the boats, you detain those on the boats, you question them, you call up the correct authorities, and you try to get to the bottom of the matter. And what's been happening? I mean, the official position on why those boats were even there it's embarrassing. I mean, initially they said there were mechanical failures, and then they drifted by mistake into those waters, or the boat was in distress. And now you have U.S. officials actually stating to U.S. news sources that they misnavigated. Or they punched in wrong GPS numbers. Another explanation was they decided to take a shortcut through Iranian waters. Can you imagine if Iranian vessels were apprehended in U.S. waters?
And they said we're just taking a shortcut, and yeah, that wouldn't really fly very far, I don't think.
But
the discourse is completely warped. It's totally warped, and so now with the nuclear deal, there are people. You know, anything Iran does is being labeled as a provocation, and then everyone's up in arms in the United States about the fact that there's going to be 100-something billion dollars of frozen assets and funds released as a quid pro quo of this deal. And they're, of course, the Republicans, neoconservatives are saying all this money is going to be used to fund terror around the world, because here's another talking point. Iran is the world's number one state sponsor of terror. Okay. No one ever questions this line, but this line's been used countless times by most U.S. politicians and news anchors and so-called experts that come on to, you know, the networks like CNN and so forth. So what is this? Where does this charge derive, the world's number one state sponsor of terror?
I think it derives from a lot of conjecture and trying to blame through spinning, the spinning of the media, events, terror events around the world on Iran. You know, you connect some quick dots, you source off the record officials, and you leak information. All of a sudden there's a narrative that's being built, and nobody actually goes to check, did anybody say this on the record? Is anybody being charged? So Iran's used to this, but I think Iran's learned a few tricks through this whole process. they've learned, for instance, that they no longer really have to support some of these narratives over the nuclear issue. One of the interesting things that came out of this deal after July is that you had a substantial part of the American body politic that started taking positions to defend Iran's behaviors, okay, because they did want this deal to go through. And that was something quite interesting. And I wrote an article about this calling it Teflon Iran, because suddenly you had you know, whether it's the IAEA or the United Nations or the White House or the State Department, clarifying things for reporters that stood to benefit the Iranian side of the narrative. And this is something the Iranians could not be heard through the media fog ever, ever, ever. So after the deal was struck in Vienna, that changed. And Iran has a partner in establishing correct and factual narratives on what's going on in Iran. But, of course, even that part of the U.S. body politic has to placate the other side from time to time, which is what we might be seeing with these new missile sanctions that I don't think are going to go very far. I mean, they target 11 individuals. And if anything, help hardliners in Iran who will continue to bang on about the U.S. being an untrustworthy partner and undermine reformists who've pushed for this deal and actually made the deal happen. There are always unintended consequences of U.S. foreign policy initiatives and American statements and American actions. The Iranians are a patient lot. They know how to play the diplomatic game. They stay within the confines of international law. And we're seeing them coming up trumps in almost every arena here in the Middle East.
So Sharmeen Narwani, also her blog is the Middle East Shuffle. There's a link to her blog on the show page. If you just click on her name, it'll go straight to, that's her main website, but she's also a syndicated columnist on a number of other news sources as well. Now, Sharmeen, you mentioned earlier, which I think is interesting, we're talking about the Iran deal. I looked at who was funding. There was hundreds, I'm not exaggerating here, upwards of $100 million in ad placements and ads produced in advance of the Iranian nuclear deal in America, and the various PACs, super PACs, and interest groups that were paying for these ads, a lot of them were Israeli-linked, okay? And that doesn't surprise a lot of people. But a lot of the money as well for a lot of the other ads were coming from Saudi Arabian-funded super PACs. So isn't this odd, or is this not so odd, that we have the interests of Israel and Saudi Arabia completely converging now in this new paradigm of power politics in the Middle East? Saudi Arabia, Israel, lockstep on so many things, especially to do with Iran, and perhaps maybe you could say Syria as well.
Yeah, they've been in lockstep, notably so since around 2012. And into 2013, I think that's when people started to notice this convergence of interests and convergence of talking points between Saudi Arabia and Israel. They, of course, were the two biggest spoilers in the lead-up to the Iran nuclear deal, and anyone who thought they'd been felled after the deal was struck in Vienna was wrong. They will come back. They will persist, as we're seeing now, trying to influence members of Congress, trying to sway perception via media articles and op-eds and the like. And, you know, sure, I guess if you're telling me they're placing ads, well, good for them. I think what they do, I understand their frustration. They've been marginalized in the Middle East. There was, you know, once a time where the U.S. would not make any major foreign policy decision in the region without going through and gaining the acceptance and cooperation of these two allies. And that, both these countries were entirely bypassed when the U.S. went full force ahead on its plans to strike a nuclear agreement with Iran. And this is a first. I certainly, nothing I've really seen since James Baker, Secretary of State James Baker, challenged Israel, you know. And I don't think either countries have helped their own case. I mean, Netanyahu trying to, elbow aside the President of the United States by speaking to Congress, and the Saudis going from one belligerent act to the next, you know, with the execution of this peaceful Shia sheikh in Saudi Arabia recently. Now there's a court case, I think. Oh no, there's a threat of a court case in the EU. Sorry, in the UK against British arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And I think we're going to see that in the United States, too. You cannot sell, by law, weapons to countries who are in flagrant violation of human rights or have carried out crimes against humanity. And as the Saudi invasion and bombardment of Yemen goes from their strength to strength, I think we're going to see more of that. You know, I was just in the UK. I know a place you've lived for a long time, Patrick, over the Christmas holidays. And I was amazed at the amount of headlines bashing the Saudis and bashing Wahhabism. And I come back to a U.S. congressional testimony. I think it was Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia, who very, very carefully and cleverly lined up the case that the Saudis are the major sponsor of Wahhabism, which is sort of a feeding ideology for ISIS and Al-Qaeda and groups like that. And nobody could argue with him. So I think we're going to see more and more of this. I think Saudi Arabia is a threat to the national security of the United States of America, and yet it's the recipient of the largest amount of U.S. weapons anywhere, you know, and sophisticated weaponry and weapons that are banned, like cluster munitions. You know, before Yemen kicked off, the Saudis, the Washington had sold, I think it was $640 million worth of cluster bombs to the Saudis. I mean, it's a banned weapon. So, you know, I think we need to see more lawsuits. We need to see more lawfare. The question is who actually puts these cases forth in U.S. courts. That's up to Americans to decide, and hopefully they will soon, because I think it's a very easy way to bring down the system, or the existing foreign policy system. In Europe, the Iranians sued over sanctions, went to the EU courts, and won, because these things are violations of international law. And in the case of selling weapons to the Saudis, Wahhabi Central, it's a violation of U.S. domestic law.
And there, you know, I listened to Brett Stevens from Wall Street Journal, this morning, and he was on there with Fareed Zakaria on CNN, and very tiptoeing around the Saudi issue. You know, so Wall Street Journal, Rupert Murdoch giving it big strong diatribe against the Ayatollahs in Iran, the usual spiel you hear, But then tiptoeing around the Saudi thing, because they're talking about, the Iranian Islamic State, it's not democratic, it's a repressive regime. Their stated goal is to spread Islamicization across the world, etc. And then in the same breath, having to carefully tiptoe around the fact that Saudi Arabia is not actually a democracy by any stretch of the imagination, but this is like becoming very obvious now. And I think that's interesting. Yeah. What you said about the headlines in the UK. I know David Cameron was hoping to seal the deal on the 120, Typhoon. I think it was Typhoons or Tornado fighters. BAE Systems was lining up that deal. That's a deal they've been working on since 2010. You know, it's a major thing. And then that's put on the rocks. They've got Serco, or someone's got some prison building deals as well in Saudi Arabia. That's been put on the rocks because of threats of executing and beheading and crucifying a young boy, 17-year-old boy. So, but here's my question to you, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, being executed. Certainly, Saudi Arabia would know this is going to elicit a reaction. Okay, so my question is, this reminds me a lot of 1914, Franz Ferdinand, the assassination in Serbia, the chain of events which unfolded after that, the cascading, the alliances lining up against each other. We're in a similar situation, maybe not exactly the same, but in terms of, you know, this alliance-based foreign policy, you know, we have blocks like NATO, Saudi Arabia, or the anti-Shiite bloc, which is Israel and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the GCC versus Iran versus Syria. How much do you think this was a staged provocation by the Saudis, or are they just that stupid?
I think one thing that's become very, very apparent is, other than the fact that these two countries are now, the Saudis and Israelis are colluding very closely on regional objectives, is that both countries seem to operate within a bubble, a perception bubble, a narrative bubble, one that's been partly of their own making, of their own construct. But they're deep in that bubble, and I don't think they can see, genuinely see the ramifications of their actions. Or perhaps being in this bubble prevents them from seeing prevents them from understanding that not everyone will react the way they would react. So when the Saudis escalated by killing, executing Sheikh Nimr, they probably expected the Iranians to act impetuously, rashly. But that's not how the Iranians operate. The Saudis, anybody can study that. The Iranians don't react that way. The Saudis did this. What? For what reason? It made them look bad. It drew a lot of negative Western press their way. And the Iranians didn't do anything. I mean, even the storming of the Saudi embassy was not by government officials, or sort of, you know, official entities. It was by people, and the Iranian government came out and condemned it and safeguarded the embassy, acted like a rational state within international law, etc., etc. So, you know, I've been worried about these Saudi escalations since 2012, the summer of 2012, when Damascus blew up, you know, a series of bombings and terror attacks. And we can see here in Lebanon, every time the Saudi side, if you will, in this region, suffers a setback, we have bombs in Lebanon. The Saudis react this way. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that this is not how normal states react. The other thing is, you know, the more we get to see these things about Saudi Arabia and Israel, the more we're going to distance ourselves. I'm talking about in the West. The more we're going to have to distance ourselves from these countries. And I frankly think the Obama strategy of, achieving a nuclear agreement with Iran was so that the U.S. and Iran could operate in the same theaters in this region without being goaded into confrontation themselves. So this deal, in effect, allows the U.S. and Iran to both be operating within countries like Syria. Now, this is from the American perspective, not from the Iranian one. To be operating in Syria and to be operating in Iraq, and this being perfectly legitimate to do so, whereas before the Iran deal, that would not be the case. So I think, you know, the more ridiculous Saudi and Israeli actions become, and they always seem to have a new one, right? They pull out of their hats and you go, I can't believe they're doing this. The more their traditional allies draw away from them, and start hedging their bets. I think moving closer to Iran was Washington looking to hedge its bets in the region because they knew at some point they could not control the jihadi genie they let out of the bottle by supporting groups and militants that were obviously of common ideology with Al-Qaeda and other extremists like that. And they knew that they would not put ground troops in there. The U.S. military is absolutely against that. They knew they could not count on their traditional allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other Gulf states, Persian Gulf states, Israel, and Turkey, because these were countries that were, absolutely behind the growth of militancy and extremism in Syria. So they needed to look for other partners, or potential partners in the region, countries and groups that really wanted to stem the jihadi expansion through Syria, Iraq, and in their quarters in the Levant and the Persian Gulf. And so they look to Iran as a possibility. It's not that Iran and the U.S. are going to be partners anytime soon, but I think they have in stemming the jihadi tide, common goals, and will work together with groups even like Hezbollah. You know, at one point early last year, a Hezbollah official said to me, the U.S. is now going directly to their adversaries instead of going through their allies.
That's an interesting development.
All kinds of dialogue and behind the scene discussions, direct ones, I suspect as well, are going on between the U.S. and its traditional foes in this region, because, you know, it's game over. This idea for regime change got out of hand, which happens to every single U.S. foreign policy adventure in the Middle East. And the turning point, though, I think people should know, came in 2012 when the U.S. went to Iran and offered, dangled in front of them, a series of incentives, by the way, during the Ahmadinejad government, okay, to get them to start talking about nuclear negotiations. So it really is the U.S. that's started to shift its positions. And the Saudis and Israelis are in great trouble because they are in this bubble. They cannot see that they're losing ground. They're losing political ground. They're losing ground on battlefields. They're losing the narrative ground, which they always count on, and they're losing ground in the capitals of their major Western allies. For Iran, they don't need to do anything. They're sitting back and enjoying it.
And so we're still going to have a bit of an issue, money that's flowing from Saudi Arabia and from Israel to fund the political insurgency in America on the right wing side, to just flatly opposing anything, any kind of detente, any diplomacy, any bilateral negotiations. It's all going to get resisted constantly. This seems to be has been the position of Israel in Saudi Arabia in terms of manipulating U.S. internal politics, even backing presidential candidates or running negative ads against certain candidates who aren't hawkish enough, for instance. Do you think that will eventually change, because they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars doing this?
I have to say, I'm not worried about this at all. You know, bring on the hawks. What are they going to do? What is a Republican hawk or a Democratic hawk, Hillary Clinton, for instance? What are they going to do exactly? I mean, we've collectively seen a redressing of the global balance of power in these last few years. A huge consequence of American actions in Syria. You know, by pushing Syria too hard, they drew in the BRICS, okay? And now the BRICS have put their arms collectively around, and I'm talking specifically Russia and China, have put their arms around U.S.'s traditional foes in that region. And we've seen ourselves moving in the last 3 years away from a unipolar world. It's a multilateral world. What U.S. president could get the U.S. military to put boots on the ground anymore? Has anyone checked in with that institution lately? There's no interest. I mean, the U.S. soldiers have borne the brunt of these silly civilian Washington misadventures in this region, okay? They've lost legs and arms, have killed themselves, suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. They've seen the stuff up close, and I don't think, and I think this is a great part of why the U.S. military does not subscribe to these adventures any longer and prevented the civilian administration from ratcheting up things on Syria. So, you know, what Republican candidate can move the U.S. military to put its boots on the grounds in the Middle East? And what international body is going to allow this any longer? I mean, when the Chinese and Russians twice vetoed resolutions on Syria, we knew that it was the end of an era. Of course, the Americans and a right-wing president can go it himself. But even then, I mean, think about it. George W. Bush needed a coalition, even if it was a figure leaf of a coalition. He needed that to create the sense that there was international consensus on this. There will be no international consensus on attacking countries in the Middle East. That era is over. So I'm not worried. Let them spend their money. Let them waste their money. I tell you, for a change, people in the Iran camp or objective governments in the Middle East that would like to seek independence and self-determination are looking at the U.S. and realizing there's nothing coming out of there. There's nothing left. You know, I think this is why a certain segment of the American population was so outraged by those pictures of the Navy Marines with their, you know, on their knees, the hands on their heads. How dare Americans surrender? What do Americans not bleed? I really think the relationship between action and consequence has been sort of rubbed out in the American psyche. You do something, something's going to happen back to you. Fortunately, they were caught by the rational Iranian Coast Guard or whoever, military forces, and brought in and questioned and fed and released. You know, if you saw Americans in that position in Saudi Arabia, they'd likely to be beheaded. So I'm not too worried, and a lot of people in this region have stopped worrying about America's reactions, whether there's a right-wing president or not. Hopefully Americans will not vote in a right-wing president. The U.S. has grown its economy over the last century because of foreign policy, but when the whole world becomes hostile to you, you can't grow economy anymore. It's time to examine diplomacy, bring in some career specialists, some area specialists, real career diplomats instead of the ideologues, and set things right again, because I don't think the U.S. has an economic future the way it sort of takes the stick approach to a lot of countries and a lot of events going on in the world. But, you know, you need the candidates, don't you, though, for Americans to vote in? What are you looking at in the Republican field right now? Is it Donald Trump still ahead of the pack?
Yeah, Donald Trump's ahead, but as I predicted before Christmas, I said don't count out George Bush, or Jeb Bush as he's known, John Ellis Bush, and he's got the endorsements of Lindsey Graham and probably John McCain this week, it looks like. So they're resuscitating that Bush, trying to prop him up in advance of the primaries. So it's far from over, although yeah, Donald Trump is very much in the lead. Americans.
Well, I actually, you know, Patrick, I think I can deal with a Donald Trump over here in the region. You know, they do say about.
Yeah. Well, it's a mixed bag, with the Donald. So.
Know how to move off a trajectory once it's on it, you know. Oh, it's like a dinosaur almost. Once it's on a path, it doesn't know how to veer from it or move backward. So perhaps Donald Trump will offer that, at least. I'm more worried about Hillary Clinton becoming president, because she really is a warmonger of the first degree. Nobody wants her around here.
I agree with you on that. Yeah, it's more of the same. Hillary Clinton will be a continuation of everything nation-building project that's been going on for the last five decades. But in America, it's more ruled by crisis. And my biggest fear is that, you know, a domestic, so-called domestic terror event is what will eventually be used to drive U.S. foreign policy in the absence of any will to do anything, as you pointed out, like before. But I always said that America's real power internationally is derived from its being perceived as an honest broker. And once you lose that mantle as being an honest broker by the world looking at you in that role, once you've lost that, that's where your power is. And I think there's almost this resistance in Washington to accept that's a fact. That is your power. It's more than guns, more than bombs. It's the perception that you are the honest broker. And so that's shifting away from the U.S. now, and maybe more towards even Russia, for instance, or even China, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, It's very true, but you know, I would say in terms of the U.S. being an honest broker, nobody here has ever thought that. Nobody. I mean, who in the Middle East except a few American proxy governments have ever used that phrase? I mean, okay, it has been used here, but this is the power of the narrative. You say it often enough, it sticks.
Yeah.
But nobody really believes the U.S. is an honest broker, and it is, you're absolutely right, it is telling that countries that would naturally perhaps be hostile to the Russians because they're close allies of the United States are now examining opening up diplomatic and economic and other channels more ferociously with the Russians. Case in point is the Jordanians. You know, they've seen the Russians far more in this past year than they've seen the Americans possibly. And I think the Russians are providing them with new nuclear plants, etc. So there are a lot of projects going on in the region. And of course, the Chinese have been there well before everyone with their economic plans, you know. And when there's pushback from nationals of countries, because remember, the Chinese were bringing their own workers at some point, other than, you know, rather than hiring locally, the Chinese said, fair enough, that's a fair point. Now we will hire locally. They're making headway in ways that nations do typically make headway. You know, you soft power. Soft power, it's that simple. The stick doesn't work any longer. And I think we're all watching more carefully somehow. You know, there's nothing more. You can't declare war unless you go through the UN Security Council, and that's just not going to happen anymore. So, I think Washington needs to take a few lessons in soft power. But there's too much arrogance there. I'm not sure they can do it. You need a new kind of thinking. And I think if you had the right kind of president, it could be top down, you know, get rid of the ideologues. But you need someone who is really willing to change a lot and doesn't really care about the insults.
Yeah, I'm not sure if
they're thrown their way. Which is kind of why I strangely like Donald Trump, you know, because I think he's one person who could brush off a lot of this stuff. The rest are kind of insiders, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you on that, you know, so maybe maybe the Caesar, the first Trump will be the first in a long line of Caesars, as the Republic shifts to the next generation of Rome. But, but moving over to Syria, okay, Is it the case that what is essentially the NATO GCC alliance or cartel or whatever you want to call it, are they still hell bent on carving out a safe zone in northern Syria? And if so, what sort of a disaster would that be if they're able to pull that off?
Well, no, I mean, you can't always go by what people say, of course. And this is, I think, the difficulty in being an analyst in the region. People lie all the time. Officials lie all the time. So, you know, the U.S. has said that a safe zone, the creation of a safe zone in northern Syria is off the table. The U.S. military has also taken it off the table. That could change because, like we always say here in the Middle East, one event can change the trajectory entirely in this region. So I don't see that happening. I think there is a great deal of discomfort within NATO towards Turkey. I think the Russians outing publicly the oil trade between ISIL and Turkey, the oil trade, of course, being the source of a great percentage of ISIS's funding and financing. Once they outed that, it was just too embarrassing. There are pictures. You can't, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. There it was, mile-long convoys of trucks heading into Turkey to sell ISIS oil. So, you know, Turkey's fallen out of favor a bit. There's also the fact that, you know, the hundreds of thousands of refugees that flooded into Europe late last year they did not come from Syria. They came from Turkey. You know, a good number of them were Syrian, clearly, but they were living in Turkey. So they were not escaping war zones. how suddenly did boat fares drop substantially? How suddenly did these waterways open to, you know, hundreds and thousands of these boats and refugees coming over to Europe? The Turks encouraged this because now they're sitting pretty again in terms of their negotiations on entrance into the EU with EU countries, because the EU really needs Turkey to turn off the spigot. So I think there isn't a convergence of interests where there was between these various NATO allies to create a safe zone in northern Syria. You know, let's not forget the U.S. military moved Patriot missiles from that border. You know, they said no big deal. It was just a normal thing. But, of course, most analysts in this region saw it as a real slap in the face of the Turks. So, no, I don't see that happening at all. And a lot has shifted. Again, post the nuclear deal with Iran, it has opened up the ability for the Americans to now operate militarily in the same military theaters as the Iranians, which means both in Iraq and Syria, the two countries can operate without getting to confrontation. So in a way, there are two kinds of battles going on in these countries, both currently on the same page, though not exactly. The U.S. wants to bolster its plans of a divided Syria and a divided Iraq. By the way, the Americans never say they want a divided Iraq, but it's very clearly all their actions suggest they do. So this will bolster the Americans want to bolster their plans of creating, at the end of the game, a divided Iraq and a divided Syria. The Iranians, the Russians, et cetera, do not want to see this. And by the way, most nationals of those two countries. So, you know, on a larger picture, of defeating and pushing back and besieging extremists, not just ISIS, but Al-Qaeda, not just Al-Qaeda, but also Ahrar al-Sham and other extremist groups. They're on the same page in other geostrategic issues. They are absolutely not, which is why we will not see a convergence of interests between Iran and the U.S. and an improvement in the relationship anytime soon. But in these areas, we're actually seeing a divergence of interests within NATO. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Turkey on one side and a great number of other NATO partners on another side, a shifting side, a side that's not quite clear.
And you've been on the ground.
Where will the Americans land on this?
Sorry, we got a little break up on the call.
Yeah, cry. We hear that a lot often. Sorry.
Little breakup on the call, but just quickly before we get to the end of the segment, you've been on the ground in Syria, multiple trips and fact-finding, message reporting, etc. How difficult is it going to be for Syria to come back to put Syria back together as a country, because it's extremely fractured right now? It's been a horrific 5 years. For the people of Syria and the diverse people of Syria, many different tribes, many different religions, ethnic groups, how hard is it going to be to bring the country? Is this a long process? Is this going to take 10, 15, 20 years? Will it actually take place? How do you see it?
I have spent a lot of time in Syria over the course of this conflict. But I will tell you, I am a rare optimist on Syria. I believe Syria will be whole again. Entirely, every bit of its territory. I do believe, and I believe that is a physical thing. Militarily, you take back territory, you own it, it will be one nation again, okay? On the political side, not as easy, right? Because there have been these divisions, sectarian, ethnic, tribal, whatever, and certain groups have found aspirations in this crisis. So, you know, like the Kurds, for instance, the Druze in the south, you know, people who have taken up arms to defend themselves were not defended by the Syrian army, because the Syrian army couldn't go into these areas so easily, or they had more important fighting to do in larger hubs elsewhere in Syria. So those kind of divisions will take longer to heal. I do think, however, if you do have the physical boundaries, you can work on the political boundaries. And there may be a case where the government, the Syrian government moving future, whether it's under Bashar al-Assad or a future Syrian president elected in Syrian held elections, may decide to allow for further autonomy in certain areas, which isn't a bad thing. We're looking at this in the United States, you know, so why not elsewhere? And I think beyond Syria also, we're going to see some big shifts in the concept of the nation state and what that means. And I'm not just talking about the Middle East. I'm definitely talking about Europe as well. And I know the CIA did a report about 2 years ago. They do these five-year trend reportings. And they said one of the things was the breakup of states into sort of autonomous areas. And I don't mean physical breakup of states necessarily, but political breakup of states. So, Syria has a long road ahead, but I do think the current status on the ground suggests to us that a military solution may be closer than we think. The rest of it will be gained through political process, hopefully elections at the end of that, and then the healing process begins. But don't forget, throughout this conflict, reconciliation events have been going on locally, sponsored by local players, sponsored by the Syrian government, sometimes by rebels. You know, they've been going on throughout Syria. So the foundations for reconciliation are already in Syria. The country just needs some stability to, enjoy and discover those processes more fully in the next few years.
Yeah, and I've also heard, which is somewhat encouraging, that if there were certain sectarian divides before the conflict, that the conflict has actually brought a lot of Syrians together, whether they be a Sunni or a Shiite or whatnot, have drawn them together under kind of the identity of being Syrian, trying to preserve their country and improve relations between groups. Is that something that you've seen?
Well, no, because it's so overtly brought barriers down among sects and among religions on one hand. On the other hand, I think regular Syrians who weren't very politicized but weren't sectarian either, just were not very politicized. You see this, the young people, the young Syrians on Twitter and Facebook today, these people who were, out to restaurants and cafes and parties before have become nationalists. You know, the threat of the collapse of the nation state brought together people not just in Syria, but also in Egypt, we see, behind nationalist slogans, And so it's kind of revived a significant segment of the population, made them think about country, made them think about governance. So I think when we come out of this, we're going to see a different kind of Syria. It's inevitable. But I do think the sectarian things are part of the healing process, and the interreligious things are going to be part of the healing process that we, I think we have quite a few years ahead.
Well, there's still a lot more that's going to unfold, I think, with this story, and be very interesting. But yes, big changes are afoot. You're absolutely correct there. But thank you very much, Charmaine, for your time. And I think the connection was not too bad. Thank you very much for your time and your work as well. And if anyone's interested in seeing Charmaine's work, go to Middle East Shuffle. It's one of probably the best. What's that?
It's Mideast Shuffle. Everyone gets that wrong.
Oh, it's Mideast Shuffle. Okay. Well, we've got a link to it on our show page. So go ahead and check that out. Great work. It's a go-to place, to get a lot of up-to-date information on a lot of things. Are you going to be in, Vienna or Geneva to cover any of those peace negotiations coming up?
No. Oh, I think there's a lot of process left in that. I'm just dying to find out who they put on the terrorist list, after sort of backing these guys up for, the last 5 years. Who are they actually going to call out? So I'm going to watch it for a while, and when it picks up and looks like there's actually something behind this process, that's when I think I'll probably check it out. But thanks, Patrick, for having me on. It was a pleasure, really.
No, our pleasure. Thank you so much. That's Charmaine Arwani. See her work there at the show page. We'll hopefully speak to her in the future as well. There's a lot going on in the region in some of these areas. And we're going to try to connect our next guest after the break, Mr. Richie Allen from the United Kingdom. We'll be right back after these commercial messages. I'm your host, Patrick Engson. This is the Sunday Wire. Stay right there.
Fool me once. Shame on you. It fooled me. We can't get fooled again.
And one of the things that I've used on the Google is to pull up maps.
I have filters on internets. I hear there's rumors on the internets.
Tune in Sundays at noon Eastern Time or 9 a.m. Pacific Time for the Sunday Wire for 3 hours of action-packed talk radio on 21stCenturyWire.com and AlternateCurrentRadio.com.
Weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Sharmtec, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Sharmtec, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharmtec.org.
Patrick Henningsen, we're in the third and final hour, and we're in overdrive, and we've got a very special guest. He's a man who has just, voices just appeared on the airwaves at Alternate Current Radio in the last week, but if you're familiar with his work, you've heard him on many other platforms. He's probably one of the biggest alternative radio programs in Europe, I would imagine, at least English language-wise, or all languages. But his name is Richie Allen, and he is the host of the Richie Allen Show. Richie, thank you for joining us this week. How are you doing?
Hey, Patrick, I'm really well, and thanks very much for having me on. A terrific program you've got here. It really is terrific, and I'm thrilled to be invited on and having a really good Sunday, relaxing Sunday. And I've been looking forward to this all day, to be honest. So, again, sincere thanks.
Yeah, well, no, thank you. It's great to have you on for the first time on this show, but I've been on your show once or twice, I think, and I like your show a lot. I mean, it's what I like about your show, Richie, is and we're so pleased to have you on the ACR network, because you're kind of like, to me, like more of an old school radio. I'm talking about what I think talk radio used to be, but isn't so much anymore. But you're sort of a retro. I don't know how to describe it. You're kind of an old school talk radio guy. I really like the way you run your interviews. You get a really huge, diverse spectrum of guests, and I get the feeling, Richie, that you do learn a little bit from each of your guests, and that goes into your knowledge bank, and then you that improves your knowledge over time. I can see that your knowledge has grown on a number of topics over the times I've heard your show. So how's that process going? Because is this one of the reasons why you do it?
Oh yeah, you're very sharp, Patrick, to say that. You're very on the money there. One of the things that is very apparent, not to me, is how much more clued in many of the people who listen to me are than me. And I suppose it makes for interesting listening, because on many of the subjects that I talk about, I really don't have a lot of general knowledge. This week I was talking about MK Ultra, for example, and the various CIA programs. And apart from, you know, looking into it and doing a bit of online research, I really don't know too much about that, Patrick. And I suppose when you're trying to reach people whom are like yourself, who really are new to a lot of this information, it's probably better that you don't have a broad knowledge. I mean, yeah, friends of mine who have been researching in this arena for a long time, they often say that to me. They often say, Richie, it's great that so much of this is new to you, because you bring that kind of natural curiosity to the program. Now, this is also a way that I can pay you a backhanded compliment, and it's not the Mutual Appreciation Society here. No, it isn't. But you do an extraordinary job, because you've been writing and reading and learning about much of what the mainstream media is ignoring, Patrick. You've been doing it for years, but yet you keep that out of, I would say you keep it out of your broadcast, but you retain the ability to remember that you've got to be careful about assumed knowledge. And you've got to always be aware that the audience might, or some of the audience might really not be up to speed on this subject. And you do a terrific job with that. The danger of knowing a lot and having been around for a long time, we're the same age, you and I, but you've been researching and looking into these subjects a lot longer than me. Of course, the danger is you get very, very stale with that. And you forget that it's new to people, but you don't. And it's one of the reasons why I love Sunday Wire. You're very mindful of that, and it suits me to listen to Sunday Wire, because, as you quite rightly said, much of this stuff is very new to me.
Yeah, well, you know, when I write, I just kind of like researching, gathering, or reordering ideas, and then putting them on paper. I separate that from what I do here on the radio network, because they're kind of two different activities altogether. And people get in a certain headspace when they read stuff, and it's a totally different headspace than if they're listening to the radio. So that's why I'd probably segregate them, I guess. And it's the same with television. You do a TV program as well, I think, on Fridays, right?
That's right.
And that's a separate, that's a whole different process than radio and writing or anything else. So that's another sort of segregated activity, if you will.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the TV thing I love, and it's good fun, and I do it with the guy who founded LiveLeak.com, which is, as everybody knows, it's one of the biggest websites in the world, and we do that. It's basically just me having opinions. And what's interesting about it is my opinions are often, not always. Now, I'm not being modest, but I'm being truthful. My opinions are often pretty, well, let's say they're not exactly learned opinions, or they're not always informed opinions. I have a good rant about certain things, and we play some video clips and we attack the mainstream media, but it's good fun. But with the radio stuff, you know, Patrick, I sometimes think, you talked about me being retro. I produced award-winning current affairs programs for commercial radio stations in Ireland. That's how I got my start. So I'm a real mainstream media guy. That's where I began. And I was trained there, and I was trained to make programs. I was trained to create radio talk programs from the ground up. In this arena, I tell you what, Patrick, there are times, even speaking with you, when you've been on the show, there are times when I sometimes shake my head during a live broadcast, and I say to myself, I cannot believe that I'm discussing this subject on live radio. Not only that, but I cannot believe that I'm understanding that the person speaking to me, my guest, is right, and they're on the money about something that would have been taboo for me some years ago. And funnily enough, even though I've been doing this particular radio show now for a year and a half, and I've been doing shows like it for about 3 years before that, I still feel somewhat of a kind of, I don't want to say kind of somewhat of a virgin to this area, but still, I still do shake my head on a nightly basis thinking, really, I'm talking about, you know, the holographic universe, really? Am I really talking about MK Ultra mind control programs, really? Wi-Fi, this sort of stuff, and yeah, I hope that never changes. I hope I'm always like that.
Yeah, I think you get more the more you do it, the more different people you speak to. It's just like diving in a different swimming pool, basically. You know, temperature's a bit different, or diving in a lake rather than a swimming pool. It's still swimming at the end of the day. But I think the way I look at radio, and the reason I love radio, I don't do any video anymore. By the way, I used to do quite a lot of, you know, some TV and some video. I haven't really done much in the last couple of years because I find radio to be the purest, for me, the purest and best way to organize my thoughts in a linear format of a show. And it's, you know, before I started doing this or was even politically active, you know, 20 years ago, I would always pick people's brains when you meet them in a pub or in a social setting, or you run into people on the train or you're traveling. You know how it is. Yeah. On a bus, and you meet the most interesting people when you're traveling or when you've gone to a function or something or rather, or you meet socially. And so this is basically just an extension. It's like having a pub, but you're getting really interesting people and experts to talk about stuff. And, but there's no beer on tap here, but it's the same, it's the same principle.
Can I just come in on that, Patrick?
Because
I think everybody knows, anybody who's worked in radio knows it's a very intimate medium. It's a one-to-one medium. You're having a conversation with, you might be talking to Hesh. But then it's you, Hesh, and it's one listener. And that's what makes radio beautiful. It's you and one person having an intimate conversation. And what's then really interesting about that is, I've read studies. Now, I know studies can say anything, and sometimes you must take studies with a pinch of salt, but I've read studies, Patrick, that people listening to information through the medium of radio are actually more likely to retain the information than if they got it through the television. And I believe that. I really do.
Because
it's that much more concentration going on. And of course, we don't listen to radio together. We watch television together. But radio is a very personal thing. We listen alone. You know, if I'm listening to Sunday Wire on Sunday afternoons, I'm not listening to it with my fiance. I'm listening to it by myself. And I'm completely gripped by you when you're doing a monologue, or you and your guest. And I'm vastly or infinitely more likely to retain what I'm hearing. So radio, I think, is more important now than ever, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And people were saying this a few years ago. They're saying that the internet is going to recharge radio in a way that, you know, television had overtaken radio in the last 50 years. And then somehow the internet was going to help to recharge through podcasts and internet radio broadcasts and things like that. And I look at the proliferation of podcasts. And it's not just that, Richie. The loyalty people have to certain podcasts and very specialized subjects too, but absolutely loyal, have been following them for years. I don't see that level of loyalty with television anymore. So I really do think there's something going on there.
I think you're totally right. And I mean, you will have listeners now tonight. Well, it's tonight now in England. Of course, you're going out live in the US, and it's in the afternoon, in the early afternoon there. You will have people listening today that you're part of their routine. They listen to Patrick Henningsen on Sunday, where on Sunday is part of the routine. And they might tie that in with, well, I clean the house when I do that. Mm-hmm. Or I go for a jog and I do that. Or I go to the gym and I do that. It's personal in a way that, as you described, television isn't. And it is powerful. And it's funny, you know, you do get presenters sometimes complaining, oh God, not another podcast, not another new radio show. I don't believe it. Not another new online station. But this is wonderful, this. The diversity of choice for people. You know, we should never be scared of choice. And we should encourage people. I often say to my listeners, you know, first of all, don't believe anything I tell you, because when I'm giving an opinion, it is my opinion. But second of all, you know, you've got a smartphone now. Why don't you use it? Why don't you use your record feature on it to, you know, vent your spleen on any one particular subject and record it for 20 minutes. And then why don't you go and upload that to a free podcasting platform and bingo, you're away.
Yeah.
You know, you've started. And I don't know if anybody's, you know, done that based on my recommendation, but I think these are really exciting times for that. We have to be the presenters and the journalists that the mainstream media won't be. And anybody can do it. And we're talking about radio now, but of course all smartphones have wonderful camera features. You know, people, you can run after somebody now with a camera. You can doorstep your local politician with your smartphone.
And
people are doing it and challenge them. Say, how dare you vote for the bombing of Syria? How dare you? Would you kindly explain it to me? I always say to people, be totally polite, by the way. Never insult people. Never use bad language. But say to them, look, I'm your constituent. How dare you? Film it. And whatever their reaction is, put it on YouTube. You know, this is the way the mainstream media won't do it. So let's do it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of a lot of people video blogging and using platforms like Vine and Snapchat and, you know, using that to get their opinion out or their issue out. There's also a lot of vanity, selfie, narcissistic stuff as well. But, you know, I think the cream separates as it rises. I think the more we go on with digital information, it's an absolute It's a completely insane sea of content and stuff, but I think people will learn to discriminate and eventually learn to separate what's what. You know, just like they can walk into a bookstore and know that this is the nonfiction section and that's the fiction section. Eventually it'll fetter itself out. Right now it's in flux and it's a little bit crazy, for some people. You know, we look at this stuff every day, so we're able to divide it and organize it in our head and know that what's what. But I think it will over time. It'll improve in terms of that. Yeah.
One of the things that's very interesting, you and I think, I'm not going to speak for you, but I think we're of a similar mind, I think, is that in my particular show, I spend a lot of time analysing something or many things that have been published in the MSM. That's kind of what I do. I look at certain stories. I might play the clips. I might read from the newspaper story, and I might attack that. But in recent months, it's occurred to me, and I have approached this with a kind of a certain sense of trepidation, and that is maybe we need, and when I say we, I shouldn't say we, I should say I need, to maybe shine that spotlight maybe on some quarters of the independent media as well as the mainstream media. And the reason I've been reluctant to do it until now is for the fear, I suppose, even though, you know, I've got a kind of a brass neck, Patrick, I don't worry too much about criticism, but I am concerned that, you know, by doing it, some of the supporters of the independent media might say, well, well, this might just be bitterness or sour grapes. Why is he attacking the independent media or some of the independent media producers? But some of what we're seeing lately, and I'm not going to mention any, none whatsoever, I'm not going to mention a single producer, or a single, I'm not going to mention anybody, but some of what I've been seeing lately, it's kind of disturbing. It's disturbing to me. Some of it is as poorly produced and is as false in terms of the information it's putting out there as the MSM. And I'm kind of fighting with myself about that, thinking, well, how do I approach that? So that's something I might look at in the coming year. I don't want to attack people personally, but, you know, there are things going on in the independent media. Even, you know, I was looking around Facebook today, and there's always a lot of interest on Sunday afternoons and Sunday where people are always sharing it, or I'm going to be listening in, kind of a thing. But in the meantime, there's all this clickbait nonsense, Patrick, you know?
Oh, my God. I talked about that.
These fake stories, yeah. What's going on?
Listen to this, Richie. I was talking about, I don't know if you listened to the first hour, but someone shared a story on my Facebook page, which the headline reads, I'll read it again. I've got many of these, by the way. I collect them, and I keep them in a little folder. But the headline reads, here we go. Putin orders 100,000 troops with atomic weapons to go blow up the CERN, underground CERN Hadron Collider in Switzerland. Okay, so I said the name of the website. It's called Your Newswire. Okay, someone shared this on my page. And I sort of take offense when people put things on my personal wall because that's like my space, you know. But I just politely said, this is what I think this is. But I see so many of these now, Richie. And they do propagate. And, Fareed Zakaria from CNN had a big diatribe about this morning. I talked about it in the first hour. And this is a good point you brought up here, Richie, because how do you deal with this? Plus other issues, you know, like Islamophobia or some of the crazy jingoistic or overly bigoted rhetoric that we're hearing more and more of in the so-called independent media, alternative media. And the fact that you don't want to criticize like what you might consider, not you, but other people might consider fellow members of the alternative media, for instance. Here's how I'm approaching this, Richie. I am saying to people now, there is no such thing as alternative media anymore. There is only media. There's no new media. There's no alternative media. There's no independent media. Although we can use these terms for people to label things. But the reality is, Richie, it's one big giant ocean full of different sized fishes, dangerous ones, harmless ones, flesh eating, plankton, you know, and harmless big plankton eating whales. You know, it's one big sea, primordial soup of information now. Because the reality is this, Richie, you are competing. You're not just competing with Alex Jones or someone else for listeners. You're competing with Anderson Cooper at CNN or Jeremy Paxman. We're in the same ocean with them, even though they're bigger fish. We're still competing for the same audience. So
it's a brilliant point,
Dad. It's all media, so I think people need to get past the tribal identifications. I don't want to be a member anymore of the Truth Movement, the Liberty Movement, any movement. Okay, the Patriot Movement, or whatever. I don't want to be labeled as such, and I do get labeled in different things. And if I criticize what someone's saying who seems to be non-mainstream, I get attacked as hurting the Truth Movement, for instance. And I personally don't believe in those identifiers, those labels. So for me, it just goes right off my back. But for some people, they really believe. And I think if we, by calling ourselves alternative media, we're ghettoizing ourselves. We're creating a kind of a intellectual ghetto, which I don't think that's healthy either. I think, you know, you're in there with everybody, basically. And this is the way the future's unfolding. And if you look at the numbers that you're doing and other people are doing, and sometimes occasionally this show does on certain weeks, we're not bad. We get a decent share of the audience. But I'm not looking at the numbers, Richie. I'm looking at the quality of the audience. Yeah. So So I'm looking at my chat room now, and I see some of these crazy people in the chat room, like DJ B2, White Bird, Elisa, Conscious Algorithm, Jazz Demon, B-Max, Spore. So they're all in there in the mosh pit, and they're listening to this show. And I know all these people are very, very au fait with all these issues we're talking about. So that to
can
me...
Can I ask you a question? I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is outrageous. It's your show, but I'm going to ask you a question. a great friend of mine in Ireland, the actress Jean-Ann Crowley. Jean-Ann was in Doctor Who, and she was in Educating Rita. She was in loads and loads of really successful theatrical productions in Ireland and abroad. One of the things she keeps asking me, because she, in recent years, she's begun to see the world a little bit differently. She's begun to understand a lot of what she's been reading in books by David Icke and others, and has probably had a, like all of us, had an inner battle with coming to terms with that information. But a very sharp, very, very, very smart woman. She's always asking me this, and I don't know the answer really, other than try to be professional. David Icke used to say, Richie, try to sound like the mainstream media. Try to be as polished. I hate to say the word, entertaining as them. But the glaring difference between you and them will be that you're talking about things that they're trying to suppress. But she's always saying, how do you make a bridge with the people who are listening to Radio 1, Radio 5 Live, Radio 4, whatever, RTE Radio in Dublin, who are uncomfortable, Patrick, with the way the world is going? How do we make the next leap to grab those people that are borderline, you know, understanding some of what's going on? How do you build that bridge? It's a $64 million question, isn't it?
I think that is a good question. I think it's sort of like this, you know, when you're waiting in line at a supermarket and, you know, they have the books there. I don't know if they still do it, but, you know, the trashy romance novels. Then there's the self-improvement books, you know, how to become a millionaire. And there's all the sort of different types of books. And then there's like ISIS is the army of evil. That's in the checkout. So even a person with a master's degree will sometimes go for the trashy romance novel or the crazy Philip K. Dick science fiction paperback, you know. Or the My Pretty Pony sometimes. You know, people like different things in their life. They don't necessarily always go for highbrow or lowbrow or middlebrow. They change. People are changing constantly. Like, I read the Daily Mail sometimes, sometimes I pick up the Sun. When I go into a cafe and I'm eating breakfast in Britain, I like to have a copy of the Sun in front of me. For some strange, maybe it's just force of habit, but I don't like to read the Telegraph when I'm having a fry up, you know?
Yeah.
I read the Sun, and it's not because I believe what's in the Sun or in the Express, but I'm very curious to see what the people who do read it are thinking and what sort of stories are prominent in their life. And I think over time people will organically migrate to the place where they feel most comfortable and most safe. And I think it's a safe place. People go to Radio 4 or Radio 1 because for them it's safe. If they don't want controversy or they like to hear the consensus reality, it's safe. And if they go to your show, they're going to get challenged a little bit more. And maybe it's not the right time for them. But over time, as word travels, little by little, one listener at a time, eventually they start piling up on your side. And yeah. I think that's what's happening.
You know what I've always tried to do over the years? I used to do it in Spain. Is I tried to bring on current or former politicians or businessmen and women who are good people, Patrick, and whom get it up to a point. You know, up to a point they understand what's going on, but they don't maybe get the, you know, the bigger picture. And I'm thinking of people whom, maybe I shouldn't mention them now because they've been regular guests on my program, but I like them a lot, but I don't think they get the bigger picture. I'm thinking of people like, for example, Ray McGovern, for example, who's a colleague of yours. at RT.
Former CIA analyst, yeah.
Yeah, an absolute gentleman there. And how dare I say Ray doesn't get it? But I'm going to be so bold as to say Ray doesn't get the full picture. I mean, Ray McGovern has brain cells coming out of his bloody backside, you know, compared to me. And he's a genius when it comes to analysing, you know, the relationships between countries and diplomats and foreign ministers and what have you. But I think, like, I would bring Ray on, we'd have a good chat with Ray, and then I would put a question to Ray, and Ray would say, ah, that's the old conspiracy there, Richie. And he would put an Irish accent on, and he would say, ah, the old conspiracy stuff. But I'm happy enough with that, because I've got him on, I've said what I want to say to him, he's not going to go for it, but he doesn't mind, he doesn't feel like he's been, he's been trapped in any way. And he'll come back, and maybe doing it that way, and you do it, so the reason I'm putting it to you, maybe that's a way to, you know, the BBC and the RTE and the CNN listeners, get these people. I used to bring Edwina Curry on in the night in Spain and Anne Wilkham and people like that for an hour, and people would go, what are you bringing her on for? It's because they get it up to a point.
Yeah.
And they're nice people. They're not evil people. They get it up to a point. And that's been my way of doing it, you know.
Whatever side of the political divide you might think you're on, I always think, you know, I like to talk to even people that I would be in the opposition of. And you do socialize and you meet people, and either through family, work, or whatever, the chances are that you're going to be interfacing intimately with people who you don't agree anything with politically, or who you don't see the world in a vastly different way that you do, and you still have to get on with them and talk, and you still have to live together, and, you know, society has still got to move forward with all the different characters and different viewpoints. And that's another thing that I think is important, is that you do got to listen to the people that you consider your opposition. You got to listen to closely to what they're saying, because then, you know, it's as important for your beliefs and positions to know what other people feel and think. And if you just shut yourself off, then the ghettoization happens. And that's kind of like what we talked to before. And there are a lot of people that you get starved intellectually if you create a ghetto for yourself. And so I think it's really important to have a diverse line
of
thought. Yes.
Yeah. You're right, and as well as that, you self-censor. You actually fall into the trap of self-censorship.
Mm.
And we've seen that. We see that regularly. One of the things that Hayden Hewitt, who runs LiveLeak.com, and Hayden would have a very different worldview to the view that you and I have. And, you know, Hayden would be very much, you know, questioning vaccines is silly. There are no issues with vaccines. Geoengineering is nonsense. And he would mean that. Hayden is not a gatekeeper. He's a guy who has got very strong personal opinions, and they're his opinions. But he's also a champion of free speech, and is determined, like you are and others, that every opinion is heard, irrespective of whether he agrees with it or not. But he's very, very critical, not of the independent media, but he's very critical of many of the followers of the independent media.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing about shutting people down or dismissing somebody because you might agree with them 7 out of 10 things or 8 out of 10 things, but on 2 or 3 things you have a difference of opinion. And then for some people then, oh, you automatically become the enemy.
And
it gets very vitriolic. And Hayden said to me, and I didn't really consider it. It never occurred to me it was a form of censorship. But he actually said, but it is. It's incredible. He said how quick discussions are shut down. Somebody is labelled a plant or a shill or this or that because they take the line that, well, I don't know about chemtrails, to be honest, then. I'm not quite sure about it. Oh, they're a shill. You know, you agree with them 80% of the time. And I thought that was just was interesting. And I just tried to avoid all that sort of stuff. And you talked earlier on.
Well, this happened to me this week. It happened two different people. One of them was a colleague who accused me of being a patriot blogger because I am sympathetic to the Bundy family in Nevada. So I'm part of the patriot movement, according to him, because of that. So, you know, forget about all my achievements in life. I'm just a patriot blogger as far as he's concerned. But, and then someone else attacked me because I wasn't attacking Israel and the Jews hard enough. And so therefore I'm in league with Bibi Netanyahu because of this. And it's kind of ironic because, I mean, I've been very outspoken in, especially in the corner in defense of the Palestinian people for 15 years. And ironically, I get attacked as being, because I'm not vociferous enough for some people. And then
It's because you're not racist enough, Patrick.
Well,
that's what it is. You're not,
And if I happen to agree with Russia's foreign policy directives of that month, I then am in league with the Kremlin. So it's like sometimes you can't win. But I find the criticism is mostly from people of my peers on this in the independent or alternative realm than it is from anywhere else. So
do you know what, though? There are a lot of very fragile people out there. There are a lot of really hurt people out there, people whom are... they really don't do well with the way things are going. And I have personal experience of this because there's somebody within my family whom has had a difficult time dealing with coming to terms with the reality of the way the world is going and you know, what's really happening in the world. And it's very difficult. And I see it. I mean, you and I, because we present programs, we get a lot of correspondence from people. And I get... correspondence maybe several times a week from people whom I think probably need intervention. They need immediate help.
God, I know.
I don't say that for a laugh now.
No.
And it sounds funny, but people whom they are on the edge, Patrick.
Yeah,
because the madness of what's going on has pushed them on the edge. And these are the people who react badly. They fall in love with Patrick Henningsen. Fall in love with Patrick Henningsen's program. They listen to Patrick. What Patrick is saying makes sense to them. And, geez, that's what I feel. And Patrick Henningsen can articulate it better than them. So the worst thing that can happen, Patrick, is a few weeks after they've committed themselves wholeheartedly to your program and to 21st Century Wire, is you say something they profoundly disagree with. Because it's like the ultimate form of treachery.
Yeah.
To them. Yeah. And that's what it is. And that's why I don't get too... bogged down by it, and it's why I don't get too wound up by it. I mean, I have blocked people, not because I don't want to hear people who are in opposition to what I'm saying, but some people, they get so vitriolic with it, and I can tell they're just not in a good space, and that's what the system is doing to people. It's really hurting them, and, I don't know if, you wanted to go down this sort of road in this conversation, but I really do see that, and maybe I notice it more because I'm so new to making these types of programs compared to you. But I do worry about people. And I get emails sometimes, I think, you know what I think, Patrick? I think, I wish I hadn't read that email. You know, because I can't help that person.
You're so correct. It's more of an issue on the sort of lower independent level than it is on the mainstream level. Because you look at how presidential candidates or politicians, they stab their constituents in the back constantly. They betray them at every turn, right?
And people don't expect you to.
And they still show up to the rally. They'll still even vote for them, you know. So there's a level of forgiveness because of the size of the star, I guess. But on the independent level, people do take it very seriously. You're absolutely right. There is a level of intimacy there, and it is cherished and valued by people. But that knife can cut both ways, and it's a very sensitive environment. And I do take a lot of care. I try to anyway. I try to reserve my energy and my vitriol for the giants, you know. So I've got my slingshot and I want to hit Goliath in the eye, you know. So I'm not really looking at David next to me. I'm looking at Goliath, and that's who I've got my sights on most of the time. So but you're right. You're right, Richie. It can go a bit Pete Tong. Smell or something like that. Yeah.
It's incredible. I had an email from a gentleman a couple of weeks back, and he, from the very beginning, he was donating £5 a month to the program, which is a wonderful gesture. And over a year, it's a tidy sum of money to to a lot of people. And he sent me this email, and it was full of rage and hurt, because I dismissed out of hand the idea that the Earth is flat. because I just don't believe that. And I probably should have been a bit more sensitive than I was in the way I put it out there. But obviously it meant a lot to him, and he took it personally. Like, you're mocking me. And I wasn't thinking of anybody in particular when I was saying it's a silly idea. But it just reminded me to be, you know, to just remember that what's happening is, you know, while we're in the middle of making programs and writing articles, we are doing that. And we're right in the middle of that. And, you know, you work 10, 11, 12-hour days. You don't have a minute to think. For a lot of people, they're spending a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and they're not doing well with it, you know?
You're right, Richie. The Earth is not flat, okay? You're correct. The Earth, but the real conspiracy is the Earth. We're inside a big volleyball, basically. So we're in the volleyball, and so what you see is a projection on the surface of the inside of the volleyball, okay?
So, I'll tell you what, Patrick, I was thinking.
Just wanted to get that straight, okay?
Absolutely right. I mean, I was, you know, if ever something happened on a news channel that made me realize just how important it is to make independent programs, to make programs offering a different perspective. I was watching Sky News this morning, and the Saudi Arabian foreign minister was on there, who I think his name is Adel Al-Jubeir. I think that's his name. I could be wrong.
Okay.
There's a couple of them. That might be the guy. And they were talking about the Iranian deal. And this guy was telling, a Sky News presenter that, you know, lifting the $100 million or $100 billion worth of sanctions on Iran was a problem, and the Saudi Arabians as a nation were a bit worried about it. And he gave his reasons, and his reasons were that, you know, Iran has shown a history of interfering in the affairs of other countries. And then he said that Iran, you know, doesn't have the best human rights record in the world. And, of course, and I mentioned this earlier on today in my own podcast.
But the Saudi guy was saying Iran doesn't have the human rights.
Saying this. And okay. the feckless rogue Sky presenter sat there nodding along with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And it took me back to my days learning how to present and produce talk radio programs. It took me back to the days when I did interviews with politicians, sometimes in the offices of the city council or the county council. And when I came back, Patrick, and my boss heard them, I would be absolutely carpeted because I didn't jump down the throat of a certain politician when they said something that could easily have been contradicted. And I used to get hammered for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trained properly. There's this Sky guy sitting there going, yeah. And at the end of it, then right back to the studio. And I'm thinking, right there is the microcosm, right there. That if ever there was a clip, you know, that you could play to people to explain why it is that there needs to be this. And I know you want to shed the term alternative and independent because it's all media now. But a different perspective, this was it. I couldn't believe what I was watching. It's probably the worst example of terrible journalism I've ever seen on television. And that was today. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, no, yeah, it is amazing. But what you're talking about, you know, that sort of what you're trained to do, which is to, you know, don't let them get away with saying something that, you know, can be refuted or is hypocritical or something. Do you know who is? So Jeremy Paxman used to be considered the gold standard for this, but I found his looking back at some of his interviews now, as I become a little more sophisticated politically, he was really playing softball most of the time, and a lot of it was stage play. Now I look at the guy that is on RT, Afshin Ratanzi, okay, has got a program called Going Underground. He is old school. He absolutely, nothing gets by this guy. He'll catch it, and he'll do it very gracefully. He'll catch it, and then he'll throw it back at them, basically. And so he's a very difficult interviewer. I rate him way higher than Paxman or any of these guys. But again, it's that old school ethic that he has that you're talking about that you were trained to do as well. And that is, it's so missing. It's so not knowing what questions to ask. I mean, even for me, it's something I've had to reverse engineer, you know, because I don't have any training in journalism, but I've had to learn just by watching other good people. So, but I don't see any of most of the stuff I see, Richie, most of the major network stuff, ABC, CBS, Fox, CNN, they don't ask any hard questions. In fact, it's so politicized. Every single media outlet is really so attached to the whatever the party agenda is of the day. The confirmation bias, you know what that term means.
Yeah.
It's so ingrained now that everything's confirmation bias. It's like depending on what angle you're facing, you know, every media outlet is, Al Jazeera is another one of them, you know. It's absolutely nailed to the U.S. State Department's foreign policy agenda. And it never veers away from that, you know. And people say, don't be so hard on CNN or the BBC or Al Jazeera because they make good documentaries. And, one reader said to me, pointed out to me, he said, yeah, he said they make good, CNN makes the best food program in the world. Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown. It's a great travel food program. It's awesome. But they don't do current events very well. And the same with the BBC. They do the best gardening programs in the world. The best antique roadshow in the world. They're awesome. But when it comes to geopolitics, they are so narrow and they are so attached to a political agenda that it doesn't even define itself as news anymore. It's not informative at all.
No, it's 24-hour commentary now.
Yeah, it's manipulative, if anything.
That's so. Right. Yeah, a big event in my life is watching the documentary Outfoxed, which I can never remember the guy.
I remember that
guy who made that.
Yeah.
And it was very subjective, obviously, because. You know, there was a specific point of view being expressed by the filmmakers, but at the same time, it was factually correct from beginning to end. And to see the level of manipulation going on at Fox in terms of coming down from Roger Ailes, the internal memorandums every day, you know, you're going to talk about this, you're going to talk about that. The Reagan Library is opening today. Make sure that you catch loads and loads of screaming patriotic children and flags and this sort of stuff, and you're thinking, you know, they're staging a production there. They're not, as you said, they're not covering news. They've completely thrown the remit down the toilet. The whole idea of, well, informing the public, finding something out that's new, and telling, imparting that information to the public. Gone, Patrick. And I never thought we'd see it coming in here. Well, we see it here now on Sky News, of course, Fox's sister channel. We're seeing it on Channel 4. We're seeing it on ITV as well. Presenters whom are there not to read a story and present an interviewee to challenge about that story, but to actually tell you what to think about it.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary to me, having grown up in the late 1990s in commercial radio, where you just couldn't imagine ever conducting yourself in that way. To see that now, and I mean, we got used to it coming out of Fox and CNN and C-SPAN, to see it now coming into the United Kingdom, and to see the hyperbole, to hear the hyperbole, and the way news is presented today is terrifying, but at the same time it's exhilarating as well as terrifying. Exhilarating because of the possibilities that it presents for people like us.
Oh, it does. It complete. I don't mind at all. I mean, and you know, part of my function is, my role is, you know, if I see stuff that I know is on mainstream network and I know that such and such millions of people saw that and took that in, and I want to refute that, I want to deconstruct it, I want to tell people how they're being brainwashed, then that's part of my job. That's something that people will tune into the show regularly to see those examples, those exhibits, if you will, these crime exhibits in media. And that's sort of what I'm doing. But it's extraordinary what we're seeing, though, because I watched the debates. If you watched any of the presidential debates, aside from the circus and the theater that goes on stage, what's really interesting, Richie, is backstage. Backstage, they have the press room. But guess what? They're calling it the spin room.
The spin room, yeah.
They're calling it the spin. I can't believe it. So it's just like, you know, the clothes are off. The emperor is just running around naked. You know, it's just a big party. You know, how it's incredible. So this shows you no more vestiges of integrity. It's gone. So this is the spin room. This is where we spin things. You know, so it's like, where do you go from there in terms of the political process, which is lived through the television so much these days? And this is what they're doing with it. It's extraordinary. So it like you said, it could open up a big opportunity for, and it is. It is opening up a big opportunity. People are going to reject this roundedly. I really believe it. But it is shocking, Richie, you know? It is.
I think what HDR is doing is terrific. I think we talked to you and I privately about the need to be what the media was supposed to be, to be the journalist who sources information independently of anybody else and puts it out there. And when something is factual, say it isn't, prove it by demonstrating that you have the facts to hand. But when you're offering an opinion based on what it is that you're talking about, that you say that. That you say, look, well, based on what I've seen, based on the evidence to hand, this is what I've come to conclude. That's sadly lacking in the independent media. But across the ACR programs, now Fab Radio is a different thing entirely. Fab is an entertainment-based platform. It doesn't do so much news and politics or current affairs. So really, what I've seen in the independent, what I've seen of the independent media, ACR is really the only platform. It's the only station, if you will, for want of a better word, that is kind of promoting those standards. You know, let's be what the media ought to have been. Let's do it that way. And I think there's a big future for that. Because, you know, these people that we talk about that are on the edge, you know, people that are doing okay in their lives, they're intelligent people, they're not quite there yet with respect to, you know, thinking or seeing some of the things that we've seen. But the way to get to those people is, in my opinion, is to be professional, to aspire to those standards that the media should have done, or that the media should be. And I think that's one of the ways. I think what you guys are doing is really terrific. It's splendid, really. It's something I'm delighted to be a part of. You know,
We're glad to have you. We're glad to have you on board, and you know we're going to add a few little pieces to the matrix, but slowly and very carefully, because you know we do want it to be a safe entry point for a lot of people who are new to the material and this way of looking at information or this perspective, but also to be comfortable for the dab hands as well. So this is a really hard balance to strike, and we're sort of making our way through it, and we'll keep it real, and but also trying to present things professionally, because I know that makes a difference. You know, it's not just the information. I tell people, Richie, it's a battle. It's not just a battle of information. It's not an information war. It's a credibility war. And how do people determine credibility? Is through trust and through some really basic principles. And it takes a long time to build that up. And it's really difficult to do. It's a lot of broken, eggs to make that omelet, But it is a trust war. And that's the real battleground. It's credibility. And so I never try to lose focus of that. That's one thing that's always in the forefront of my mind. But yeah, we got a good little family at ACR. You know, we're just a skeleton crew as it were, but, you know, we're building up slowly and we're really happy with the progress that we've made so far.
and reaching a lot of people already. I'm always mindful of something Michael Franti said in that Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy song Television, that we are in an era where image has taken precedence over substance. It has done. But you know what? Why not embrace that? If that's the level you have to reach people at, if you have to keep that in mind, you know, if the package has to be all glitzy and, you know, all glamorous, so be it then. You know, if that's, you know, sometimes you talk, you know, it's not, we've heard the old saying, if you can't beat them, join them. Well, maybe sometimes you have to join them to beat them.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be like them. And that was something that way back when I first met David was very, very specific about that. Having worked for the BBC for so long, David said, why not aspire to those polished, slick willy type standards of the mainstream? Why not? As long as your information and your integrity is better than the mainstream media, it doesn't matter. But be like them, but only in the way you package your product. I think there's something to that, I think. And your programmes, whether it be the Albrecht Show or the Boiler Room or yourself, they have that polished mainstream type feel to them. You might not like me saying that, but they do. And, yeah, and more power to you for them being like that. That's what I try and do. I listen to BBC Radio 4, listen to BBC Radio 5, and I want people listening to my show in a car to think, what station am I on? Am I on the BBC North West, or am I on whatever? I want people to think that, make that mistake, because it means that, you know, we're polished. We're performing on the same level as these people. And then, to return to what you said earlier on, it's one big media then. There isn't an alternative media or an independent media. It's just one media. I like that concept, to be honest. I really do.
Yeah, but going forward, I think that's a healthier way to be thinking, not just for us as presenters or producers, but also for the audience too. You know, that, you know, we should be held to the same standard as we're trying to hold CNN to the fire, then, you know, we're going to be held to that same fire, I'm afraid. But there's some people that want it both ways. And I'm afraid it just not, I don't think that's the way forward. It's, you've got to be held to the same standards of critique as the mainstream media. But also I think it's about exceeding expectations. People come, to a program or they listen to a show. They expect, if they got something good the previous show, they're expecting to get equal or better the next show. So it's about exceeding expectations. And, you know, so maybe that's it's not so much about how polished you are as such, because people have different deliveries, but it's about,
of course, yeah,
it's about exceeding expectations. And that's what I think. If you try to do that, whatever you do, not just in media, but especially in media, but if you aim to exceed the expectations of your audience, you will always find some level of success. And I think that's a thing never to lose sight of. And it's not about the glitz and the glam. It's down here anyway, because obviously we don't have the production budget that Anderson Cooper has or somebody. So we're in the battleground of ideas here. And so we have to come with really good ideas, because, you know, we don't have the shields and the swords and the crowd as such, but we need to have really solid ideas. And so that also is part of the ethos. That's got to be uncompromisable. You got to come with original ideas, original stories, original angles every day, every time you're presenting somehow, some way. It's got to be, you know, original, and it's got to be unique. And I think if you do that, you'll find your audience. And that goes out for anybody out there. Not just you. I mean, I'm talking to the choir here, but yeah, I truly believe that. So, but yeah, so I think, looking forward. So what have you got? What's the Richie Allen Show looking like in the next year? Are you going to change the format? Are you going to go for different guests? Are you going to carve out some new territory maybe somewhere? What are your plans?
It's a good question, that, Patrick. Going to try and keep growing the audience. It had a very good start. It leveled off in terms of figures and numbers, and then it picked up again. And it's getting. I'm very lucky, and I was very lucky early on to have the backing of David. I've never been, you know, I've never been under any illusions. That was very helpful early on. I've known David a few years. David said, look, I'll put the program on davidicke.com and I'll promote it because I believe in it. Because he's an old guest of mine going back years on commercial radio. I used to bring David on commercial radio programs. And he couldn't believe this. He couldn't believe that we were getting away with it. And we got to know one another. And that was a big deal, that. And that was a great start. But since then, using that start, it's grown into something that's got a pretty big audience. But there's a but there. I want to talk to people, Patrick, whom are predisposed or are of a mind not to agree with us, who think differently, who thinks that largely what we are is conspiracy theorists. I want to reach those people. How I do that, I don't know. One of the things I'm going to do is invite more and more people from public life on the programme. You know, it takes a bit of doing, because a lot of the time they're reticent to come on, because they, this guy, he's got some very seriously silly opinions on.
Yeah, it's risky for them, Richie.
It's risky for them, it is. Yeah. But I've had success, Patrick, over the years where others haven't. Just by being, maybe it's the Irish in me. You know, just by that kind of, there's a kind of a playfulness. I'll ring people up and I'll say, come on and have a chat with me. And, this guy's all right. Where's the show going out, Richie? Well, it's going out on Fab Radio. It's going out on ACR. And it's sponsored by David Icke. I don't want to come on. And I'll say, but why not? What difference does it make? And then I'll have a bit of a giggle with them. And largely, it's positive. Largely, they'll say, go on, then I will come on. And I'll always say, what difference does it make? You know, if you disagree with David on certain things, don't you believe in free speech and don't you believe in an open conversation? And Patrick, that gets to them sometimes. And they'll then say to me, all right, okay, Richard, I hear where you're coming from. And I've got Labour politicians coming on the programme. You know, I have had this year front benchers, back benchers coming on to talk to me about stuff. And they know full well that I believe in things that, you know, they would believe to be conspiracy theory, but yet they come on. So I want to do more of that because I think, and it's only my opinion, and I mentioned my friend earlier on, Jean Ann, whom the American listeners will probably remember from Tenko, the great theory set in the Far East, the Japanese prisoners of war, the women, Tenko. She's always saying that, try and reach those people that are reachable, that just are not there yet in opening their minds. Reach them through more mainstream guests. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to go mainstream, far from it. You know, I want to hear from alternative media producers more than anybody. But, yeah, I want to try and reach out to more people working within public life whom are just on the edges, Patrick. Good people, decent people, the likes of Paul Flynn in the Labour Party, Piers Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn's brother, people like that. Get them on. Ultimately, they don't believe in the greatest conspiracy.
Is Piers Corbyn is Jeremy's brother?
He's Jeremy's brother.
Are you serious?
Yes, and a lot of people.
I met Piers Corbyn in Copenhagen in 2009. I didn't know they were brothers.
And a lot of people don't. And don't.
He's brilliant. Piers Corbyn is a brilliant physicist. He's very good at what he does, predicting weather.
He is, and we had him on talking about climate change. But I got into geoengineering with him, and he said, yeah, I do believe it's going on, Richie. He's the you know, would-be Prime Minister's brother, and he's talking openly about it. And I'm thinking, you know what, Patrick? There might be somebody, just one person listening, who otherwise would have thought this was a load of nonsense, but because Piers Corbyn said it.
Well, you know what's brilliant about that is that Jeremy, being the consummate left-wing archetype, he'll be, generally those people are pro, they believe in man-made global warming and that we need to have carbon taxes and all these things. And then that's his brother who you would class on the very conservative wing of, the climate is not changing because of carbon dioxide from man's output. So that's in one family, isn't it? So there's the diversity right there. That's a microcosm of society. And that shows that you need a dialogue, you know, between these different sides. This is the problem, is that there isn't enough dialogue. But that's fascinating.
I remember talking to Edwina Curry on the radio about the creation of money. And I used to say to Edwina, why do you come on with me, Edwina? There's nothing in it for you. That's what I used to say, you know. There's nothing in it. And she would say, I don't know, I just like to debate, Richie. I like a good argument. And I thought, you'll do for me. You will do for me. Because I like, you know, Edwina was right about Salmonella. And she's a Tory. And they're obnoxious, most of them. You know, the privileged classes. But she's a decent woman, a decent human being. And I remember getting through to Edwina. I remember ringing Edwina once to say, will you come on and take a question from me about Jimmy Savile? Yeah, she said. And she knew damn well that it was a so-called conspiracy programme. But there are people like that, and they're very useful. She said, I will. Why do you want me? I said, because you were Minister for Health, and, you know, you knew that Savile was going into certain hospitals. But she didn't know what Savile was up to. She did not. But, you know, I mean, she regrets it now, of course. But
well, a lot of people thought he was, you know, just a face of children's charities, and
that's right.
A cheeky chappy, a DJ, and then but then there were people who did know, but maybe not so many, I would think. But the majority of people just the public persona was incredible. It was bigger than life, larger than life.
They're so useful, these people, Patrick. Michael Meacher, rest in peace. Michael Meacher.
Oh,
what
my
a lovely
goodness.
Man. Total gentleman. But he believed in, you know, he believed in climate change, and he believed in the European Union. I don't mind that, you know, because Michael Meacher was a great man. He was a real socialist. But I remember arguing with Michael about the same subject one night on the radio about money. Mm-hmm. And to his credit, what a complete gentleman. To his absolute credit, he argued with me. He argued with me that black was white, that today wasn't Monday, it was Tuesday. He argued and argued and argued. And he said, you know, the money system was fine, the central bank. And he disagreed with me about the place of central banks. And he really didn't understand them. And I couldn't believe this really intelligent, learned, smart, educated man, much brighter than me. He didn't get it. But what was amazing was about 6 weeks later, Michael came back on the radio show, and he had the courage to say, do you know what? He said, I've been thinking very hard about some of the stuff you were talking about, Richie. And he said, you're right about the money, the way money is created, the way it's created as debt, the way it's loaned into existence and stuff like that. And he just hadn't ever considered it in his life. You know, the gold standard had come and gone. Money was being created as thin air, but it never occurred to him. But I thought, what a wonderful guy. He came back on, he said, yeah. And I said, well, if you consider that, Michael, what else might you start to consider, you know? And
well, Michael, he's one of their first sort of official political people to come out to question 9/11 official story, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so he's quite brave, actually.
He was incredibly brave.
In that sense.
He was a brilliant environment minister in Tony Blair's first cabinet. Mm-hmm. He wasn't environment secretary. He was given a ministerial role at the Department of the Environment. Tony Blair hated Michael Meacher.
Tony Blair hated anybody that was potentially popular. He hated Mo Mullen. He hated anybody who was competition, basically.
Genuine socialist, Patrick. If you were a genuine socialist, he hated you. Because Blair was slipped in there to continue the policies of Margaret Thatcher. Yeah. As you and I well know. And of course, Meacher and you mentioned others there, they were, you know, potential flies in his ointment.
Well, Margaret said so herself.
that's right. Yeah. So. Couldn't have done better than this guy getting elected, yeah.
Yeah.
I give you a very long answer there. I want to try to get to more people that would ordinarily think that Patrick Henningsen and Jim Mars and David Icke are crazy. I want to reach more of those people. Because Patrick Henningsen, David Icke and Jim Mars are not crazy. They're wide awake and asking the questions that the mainstream media doesn't dare ask. And I want more people to hear people like you. But not the converted, not people who understand it already. We need to forget about entertaining those people with interviews with people that they like and that they're used to, comfortable stuff like that. Let's get away from it. Let's try and reach those people who are beginning to feel very, very uncomfortable about the world. That's what I want to do. I mightn't succeed at it. Or maybe I will in a tiny way. But that's the ambition for 2016. And, you know, we'll see how it goes, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, that's what you need to do. That's what everyone needs to do, is pushing the envelope, pushing the boundaries, and this is the only way that you can achieve any progress, achieve any innovation, to move forward, is by pushing the envelope, whether you're in a creative field, whether you're making films, whether you're making music. Speaking for someone who pushed the envelope most of his life, we were talking over the break, David Bowie is a good example. You know, when you think of David Bowie, what do you think of? Do you think of, when I think of Mick Jagger or Keith Richards, what, the first thing that comes to mind is not music, it's what? It's drugs, usually.
It's drugs, yeah, yeah.
It's booze, or it's drugs, or some salacious, vision. When you say David Bowie, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, to me, it just would be, chameleon, the ability to reinvent yourself, to change, to be something different.
Or artist, art.
Or artist, yeah, art, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the first, I think of him, really, the word artist, it comes there. Not because it's a label, because I see him as, he is an artist, you know. He is the masterpiece, is him, you know. But I don't think the same way about all these rock icons, you know. They don't hold the same position in my mind. But David Bowie really pushed the envelope.
It was amazing. I saw him in 95 in the Point Depot in Dublin. Morrissey was supporting him, which is the only reason I went to the gig. Because although I knew Bowie's music and I didn't have anything against it, and I would have liked some of it, didn't know a lot about him, and I only bought a ticket to see Morrissey. But I came away from it a Bowie convert. I started buying all the back catalogue then. I bought the Berlin albums, Low and Heroes and... way back, Ziggy Stardust. Just started buying all the stuff and listening to it and fell in love with it. But only ever saw him at one time, Patrick. Did you ever see him live?
I've never seen him live. You know, he didn't play very much live.
No, he didn't tour very much.
So you were lucky to see him.
Very lucky. I'll tell you a funny story about that. One of the greatest radio presenters that ever lived is a guy called Jerry Ryan. Jerry was a radio presenter for Radio 2 in Ireland for many years. He was one of the first great talk presenters on radio in Ireland who threw his program open to the public, and people would ring him up to talk about their lives and their experiences. He was an amazing morning radio presenter. And the particular weekend Bowie was in Dublin, on the early part of the tour, he'd been playing mostly new material, and he'd been annoying the fans who, you know, had bought the tickets months in advance and wanted to hear all the old stuff. And Bowie wasn't doing it because he wasn't in that frame of mind, in that headspace. But Jerry, being this amazing Irish radio presenter, terrifically talented, he got Bowie on the phone on the morning of the concert in Dublin and basically said that there'd be absolute murder unless he gave the Irish fans what they wanted, which was a nice mix of some of the new album, but also the great old hits. And of course, Bowie came out and did a greatest hit set, which was amazing. And I remember that about that gig, and I remember that about that presenter, because he was an absolutely fantastic radio presenter in the mainstream. Sadly, you know, a dying breed. Well, he did die. He did pass away a few years back. But that was an amazing experience for me, seeing Bowie, and never saw him again. That was the one time, and I barely remember it now. But changed. Yeah, it was certainly kind of a life changing thing. And he was terrific. It was interesting to see, of course, in the last few days after he died, all the nonsense about the occult on some of these clickbait sites, which just make you want to just punch, you put your fist through a window. There's all this stuff on, you mentioned Your News Wire, there's another one called Before It's News, and all these stories about how Bowie was a conduit for occultism. It's just nonsense.
Yeah. Well, I identify him as a Brixton boy, you know. You come out of Brixton Tube Station and you cross over the road. There's a brilliant mural that someone painted a few years ago of him, Ziggy Stardust, and some stuff he's got going on there, and the hair, different color hair and stuff. This is a brilliant sort of tribute to one of Brixton's famous, products there, David Bowie. So, and I think that sort of real, that South London grit, you know, that keeping it real, as they always say in South London, Bowie, he had that, you know, he always kind of kept it real in a way, or at least real for himself. And I think that's why he's so respected, by so many people.
Yeah, it was an interesting week. Death is a part of life. A lot of people who work tirelessly to promote the cause of Palestinians were upset with the death of Alan Rickman, whom you have to say was obviously a brilliant actor. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know too much about acting. As I said, I have a friend who's a great actress, but this was a very, very powerful presence on screen. And obviously a very nice guy. And of course, he did the Rachel Corrie thing, which endeared him to supporters of, you know, the just cause of Palestinian rights, and that was a big blow. Malcolm McLaren as well, and the Sex Pistols. It's been an interesting and probably a sad week, but yeah.
Wow, Malcolm McLaren passed this week.
He did. He passed away. Yeah.
Oh wow, I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah. About Alan Rickman, he seemed like a real gentleman. Alan Rickman took a lot of flack. When he stood up for Rachel Corrie and I think Tom Herndahl as well, but he did take, and that's not a popular thing to do in Hollywood, to, you know, go against the Israel grain, as it were. It's not popular if you're in Hollywood. That's just a fact. That's a political statement. It's nothing else. It's a fact of politics, and so he's very brave by doing that. But great actor. Great artist.
Absolutely. He was. I was listening to Gareth Ike, and Gareth's very interested in the Palestinian cause. And Gareth's done a lot of work with sending football shirts over there for the children and stuff. And you know Gareth very well, of course. And Gareth was the first.
When he was a musician, when he had a band.
Yeah.
A band called Cody. And he did a gig for us in Hoxton Square. This was like 2006 or something, or 5, I don't know. But he was so, I just remember him being young and really talented, very energetic as well. But so he's sending football jerseys to Palestine.
Well, he has been, I think that's been going on for a couple of years, Patrick. Gareth is a massive, massive soccer fan. And he's a big fan of Derby County.
So are they getting Derby? So he's converting all the young Palestinians into Derby County supporters.
I hope. But if he was doing that, I'd be tearing him to pieces on the radio show. Don't do that to the kids. Life is difficult enough for the children of Gaza, without saddling them with bloody Derby County. But no, he started encouraging fans of his music to send him their used soccer jerseys. So it could be anybody. It could be Liverpool, Manchester United. It could be Brentford. It could be anybody.
And
they sent him to the kids because obviously it's very important. While all this is going on, and while apartheid, let's call it what it is, while apartheid reigns in Gaza and on the West Bank, it's important that the children get time away from it and that they play football. So as well as sending them all the shirts, they send them footballs and magazines and posters and pictures, and it's a wonderful thing. And he was doing it, you know, up until late last year, and we were sending him on our old football shirts. And so Gareth was tweeting quite a bit about Rickman because Gareth had seen the play that Alan Rickman did. I think he'd gone to see it, so it meant a lot to Gareth. So great guy, and as you said, you know, it took a bit of guts to stand up and take that position as he did.
Yeah.
If only there were more like him, Patrick, in public life.
Well, it's a great legacy, too, to produce a play on that subject. Yeah. It's a legacy that will live on in way past his time. So I think that's admirable, to say the least. But, quite a week, Richie, in terms of icons. Icons passing through. Passing through this realm in the three-dimensional universe, as it were. But we'll wrap it up, not on a sad note, but on an up. You know, those are great people you just mentioned, Richie, who've done some tremendous contributions to our lives and our culture, giving color to our world. So we should celebrate what they've done and the journey that they had with us. So I think that's
absolutely
not negative at all. Not one bit.
No, and these people taught people, if they taught people anything, it's a thing for yourself. It's to use your own brain. And Bowie's a perfect example. I know you want to wrap it up, so I'm not gonna bore you, but he was a perfect example. If I believe in something and if it makes sense to me and if I love it, well, I'm going to display that. I'm going to put it out there. And it doesn't matter whether it's commercial or not or whether anybody else likes it. And I tell you what, if everybody in the world could adopt that attitude, I couldn't care less what anybody else thinks about how I feel or what it is that I like. Patrick, it would be game over for the system. Game over.
Yeah, well, it would be the new system. The new system. Yeah, well, I think we're seeing a lot of that, Richie. I really see more and more of it. We're heading into a different paradigm. You know, the rules are changing, playing field's changing, everything's changing. The tools of the trade are changing too. So it is a very interesting time to be alive, I would say. So, but, thank you so much for your time, Richie. It's been great, having a chinwag here on the Sunday Wire, and hopefully we'll do it again at some point. I heard noises that you might appear in the Boiler Room on ACR as well soon, or you might do a little cameo there at some point.
Yeah, I'd be honored, Jan. I'm really, really thrilled you invited me on today. It's been great. Really enjoyed it.
No, we're really happy to have you on, and I'm sure the boilerplate crowd there will love to see you on the Boiler Room too. And also, just to also tell people more about your show, which is now on ACR, so Richie Allen Show, you can catch it if you're in America. I think, correct me if I'm wrong on the time, but I think it is 12 p.m. till 2 p.m. Pacific. Is that right?
Spot on. Yeah, that's the one.
12 to 2 Pacific, and that will be 3 till
3 till 5 Eastern.
3 till 5 Eastern, and on UK time, it's 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., right?
That's the one, and to wrap it up, it's 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Central time, I think.
Okay. So that's
That's about right, Chang. Yeah.
And that is live. So that is a live feed. Great show Monday to Thursday, and then you've got your TV show on Friday, right?
Yeah, we record a TV show in Manchester on Friday mornings early, and we turn it around quick and we get it on YouTube by late afternoon. And it's usually 45 minutes of opinions based on mainstream news stories. We look at the mainstream media. We grab a few clips, and we generally have, a good rant, basically. And that's the TV show.
So that's on YouTube. We've got a link to Richie Allen Show website on our show page right now, so you can go check out, see his archive as well. You can access it there, and also here on the live stream on ACR Monday to Friday. So, Richie Allen, thank you so much. We'll look forward to seeing you again, and a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff going on this year. This is going to be a wild and woolly year. I can feel it already.
It certainly is, Patrick. It was an honor. Thanks for having me on. Continued success to you, everybody at Sunday Wire. It's a great show. It really is. It's essential listening every Sunday. There's nothing like it. And to Hesh there in the background and everybody else, thrilled to be associated with you guys. Really am. It's an honor. And we'll talk very soon, mate.
There he goes, Richie Allen, ladies and gentlemen, from the Richie Allen Show. Check out his show and his work. You can catch on ACR here live. And yes, thank you to Hesher. We had an absolute storm before this show. Technically, I was bouncing off the walls, and Hesher came in, our ACR board producer, and he calmed it down. He calmed it down. He gave me a shot of calmness, and we got the show on the road. But so there are things going on behind the scenes sometimes, technically, that are just unexplainable. But this is the digital world we live in. So thanks to our team at ACR for helping smooth that out. And it's been a pretty good ride this week. We got a great show lined up for you next week, so you do want to stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. This has been the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Take care.
have weak joints? Is it making your life hard? Sharmtec, nature's best kept secret for strong joints and a powerful immune system. Sharmtec, the product with bite. Visit us at www.sharmtec.org.
I'm Patrick Henningsen, host of the Sunday Wire, and you are tuned into AlternateCurrentRadio.com. That's me in the corner.